It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. I am back, but there's a lot of tech news I missed. We're going to ask our panel, Amy Webb of the Future Today Institute and Mike Elgin of Gastronomad.net, what I missed. Lots of stories this week, including the latest about the Apple iPhone, Apple Watch, Google's Play in China, and a whole lot more. Stay tuned. TWiT is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 685, recorded Sunday, September 23rd, 2018. Emotional Support Ham. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron makes cooking fun and easy. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/twit. And by WordPress. Reach more customers when you build your business website on wordpress.com. Plans start at just $4 a month. And get 15% off any new plan purchase at wordpress.com/twit. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. I'm Leo Laporte. You may have heard of me. I used to work here for many years, and then I took a long vacation, longest I've ever taken, thanks to Becky Worley, who filled in. Who else filled in? Was it Jason? Ian Thompson. Thank you guys for doing the show. How many shows did I miss, Karsten?
Three.
Did anything happen at all while I was gone?
Nothing.
That's what I thought.
Nothing at all.
I got back.
Boring.
It's exactly the same. Joining us from the future, Amy Webb. She's written the book called The Signals Are Talking. She's at the Future Now Institute and is just fantastic. We always love having Amy on the show.
Hey, everybody. She
actually introduced me not only to the future, but to Japan, which is a little bit of the future.
A little bit.
Thank you for being here. Amy is got a little cold. Did I say the future now? It's the Future Today Institute. I'm sorry.
It's today. It's now.
It's with it. It's futuretodayinstitute.com.
Yeah.
Apologize. I always say now. Also with us, Mr. Michael Elgin, who is a world traveler and so understands when I say I'm a little jet-lagged.
Yeah. I'm from the present, not the future.
I'm way back.
Welcome back to reality,
Thank
Leo.
You.
We missed you.
No, you didn't. But anyway, I'm glad to be here. I would say I missed you guys, and I did a little bit.
Lukewarm.
You know, it was great not having, you know, we were on a boat, so there's very little internet. And T-Mobile and Google Fi work pretty well to give you internet when you're in port, but I wasn't actually anxious to find out what was going on. I hear there was an Apple event. It's 2 years in a row now that I've managed to be out of town during an Apple event. I'm going to keep that up.
Long story short, they're the best phones Apple has ever made.
I have the new watch. I'm wearing the new watch, and I'm pairing it right now, and I'm, we'll look at that new face. And then I also have an XS. I'm going to call it the XS. I'm sorry. The XS Max coming tomorrow, but I was a little perturbed because I saw the XS Max. It, first of all, it looks a little stretched out, like a little tall, right? Yeah. Kind of like the iPhone 6 did when it, 6S did when it, or 6 Plus did when it first came out. But then I was a little perturbed because I still noticed six rows of icons, and I thought, well, they just made it the icons bigger. It's not more. There is a little more screen real estate, and we have a demonstration. This is the iPhone XS, and this is the iPhone XS Max.
Wow.
That's amazing. So,
Mike, it's an extra quarter inch.
Mike pointed it's about, according to somebody in our audience, Jim, who's a developer, he said it's about 13% more. But this is in Safari. You're seeing a little more of the page. Mike likes this because you see the Arthur's byline.
Yes.
But for a lot of things, it'd be my guess that it won't give you more screen real estate. You just get bigger icons.
Yeah. I mean, to a large extent, it'll be up to the developers.
Right.
And how they want to use it, whether they want different versions and so on.
Yeah.
But I also think, you know, part of this is just keeping a certain level of consistency among their different phones. Now they have a relatively
small one.
But
why do a bigger phone if you can't, if somebody can't take advantage of it? Is this just the phone
China
for old eyes?
China loves the big phones, and
they love gold.
They love gold, and they love status symbols like iPhones, and that's one big reason. So,
and the other big reason is the aging population in the United States. So those phones were not built for. Well, I mean, it is. They were not built for Donald Trump because they are enormous. Hard to hold in one hand, and they were not built for younger people. These are phones for people
Is that because he has little hands?
He also has bad eyesight, so I'm not sure.
Quantitative data on this.
Actually,
either
the president, as I remember, unless he's updated, uses a fairly old phone still.
Lately, he's been tweeting with an iPhone. For a long time,
it was a Samsung. It was old Samsung.
Right.
Now he's on an iPhone, but I don't think it's the latest iPhone.
Let's just hope whatever it is has actually been locked down in some way. But this bigger phone, I think, is Mike is right.
Folks.
So it's for China and it's for a certain demographic in the U.S.
I actually was impressed by the XR, which we don't have yet. It won't be out till next month. But the XR, which is an LCD based, not OLED based, looks actually like the phone, like the iPhone that was for many years.
The other thing is that Apple slowly, now that we're definitely in the post-Steve Jobs world, they're slouching toward becoming an ordinary company. Under Steve Jobs, Steve Jobs was like, this is the phone.
Right.
There's only one phone.
Right.
We make it, and this is it, and you have to buy it. Now they're becoming like a regular company. Samsung would be an extreme version of that, where it's like, well, we have a phone for kids, and we have a phone for people with big hands, and we have a phone for people with horrible eyes, and we have this phone, that phone. So, 10 years from now, Apple probably have 15 phones, a big lineup, because they'll be more of an ordinary company.
And it's my understanding, but I was in a distant land where no news penetrated, but that they kept the 7 and the 8 as well as the iPhone 10 well as the 10S.
Well, one of the most interesting things about the announcement was that they had someone come on stage and talk about their environmental initiatives, and they looked pretty serious, and they announced some pretty serious things like getting away from rare earth metals and things like that. But one of the things they emphasized was they made the point, which I've made in a column, lots of people have made in the past, the only phone that is environmentally friendly is a phone that's never manufactured. And the way you don't manufacture phones is you get a lot more use out of them. They say they're planning to do that. They want their phones to last for years and years and years. So I think they're working on some plan to have their lower-end phones actually be older phones that are refurbished and so on, even more than they do today. They do that to a certain extent. I think it's great. I think it's great news. And let's hope that is, in fact, the case, that they make these indestructible phones that are in use for 12 years, and that's their low-end phone.
But Apple's a hardware company, so that they're going to have, what's the business model in a...
Charge $3,000 a phone. They're heading there, clearly.
Well, part of the model is expand the universe of people buying phones, right? Instead of saying you got to buy a new one, find people who haven't bought an iPhone yet. And there's still plenty of room for expansion, isn't there, in India?
For about 10 years.
China. Yeah,
I mean,
eventually
there is expansion overseas, and we're at the beginning of the end. So this is the beginning of the end of smartphones. And, I know that they've had a great...
I know you want to talk about the beginning of the end and what what is next after smartphones, because Amy has
she's already tired of them.
It's not that I'm tired.
Save that.
So everybody's very, very excited about the Apple launch. And again, what are the significant changes between the current phones and the previous phones? What is the measurable, discernible difference that would cause somebody who is not a hardcore, tech aficionado to go out and purchase a more expensive phone? Right. I mean, there's very, very little difference between what came out and what already existed. So we're seeing negligible new developments. And at the same time, there are all kinds of peripherals. So, Leo, you've got a brand new iWatch. Mike's got an iWatch. If you have a certain amount of disposable income, you're probably not going to go and continue on that 2-year brand new phone cycle. You're probably going to buy a peripheral. And there's more and more smart peripherals that are coming to market. So, we're only seeing incremental differences in these phones. We're going to probably see less. We know we're going to see less phones and more other kinds of devices.
And less differentiation between the phones that come out.
Right. That's right.
It's hard to find a differentiator these days.
Yeah.
That's why Apple's probably doubling down on things like security and privacy, because that's one thing Apple can say
is a differentiator in Apple's products.
Apple is either going to plateau as a company and start declining, or they're going to launch into entirely new businesses that are only tangentially related to phones and computers and
things
like
that. Isn't this the classic, though, the you know, innovator's dilemma? This is the classic problem for a successful company, especially a company with a big hit like the iPhone.
It's a big problem for the most successful company, because how much, what are they going to become, a $3 trillion company? I mean, what are they going to do to continue the growth?
And new
they'll try. And I think I'm still a believer in the Apple car.
I'll tell you, I'll tell you where the iPhone is a big hit. Thieves.
Oh, they love them.
Our Santa Rosa Apple store was hit at the end of the month, last month, and Megan Maroney was in there this afternoon picking up her iPhone. She just tweeted, "I was minding my own business, waiting for my Apple Watch, when some dudes robbed the Santa Rosa Apple store." Same store that was robbed a week ago.
Wow.
Last time they took $35,000 in stuff.
So great that they did that.
Isn't everything locked down? How did they do that?
I don't know, and I certainly don't want to spread the... spread the word, but I suspect they're locked down with cuttable cables would be my guess. And thieves must know this. And what it shows also is the success of the kill switch, because Apple was concerned about how many iPhones were being stolen out of people's hands, out of their pockets, and made it impossible for a thief to take your phone and reuse it.
Right.
So now they're stealing them brand new from the Apple store. I imagine off trucks, anywhere you can get a phone before it's activated.
Yeah. And there's a lot of this. This one store has been hit twice. In this area, in the greater sort of Northern California area, I think there have been something like 10 or 12 in the last 6 months or something like that. It's really become a big deal. And, you know, freaks out the customers. Apple's got to do something with those phones that are on display. It doesn't seem like that hard of a problem.
You know, I haven't heard about this happening on the East. I'm on the East Coast. I haven't heard about Apple stores getting hit like in New York.
Well, the East Coast is always behind on technology. You'll catch up to the stealing stuff out of the Apple store thing.
Sizzle.
Well, already, my watch just woke up. I already see one difference in the extra 2 millimeters. The text at the bottom of the screen is now curved around the watch face instead of straight.
Definitely worth $500.
I am so... This is part of the frustration I have with the Apple Watch, too, is you don't think of a watch as something you're going to buy a new one of every year, or do you? I don't know.
You do now.
Well, I mean, we're habituated to waiting for... This is the problem, quite frankly, that I have with America versus China. In America, we become habituated to the idea that everything must work perfectly out of the box, regardless of how new the technology is. And if a company isn't on some kind of annual product launch cycle, then they've somehow failed. I would rather, you know, like Apple's now, everybody's releasing a new, you know, Apple's releasing a new set of products basically now annually. And
Silicon Valley story. If you don't double every year in growth, if you don't this is what, and the Silicon Valley brought this upon itself by such success that the market, the stock market and consumers and we in the tech press demand this now.
But if you stop and apply like logic, which I know the market doesn't love.
It's unsustainable.
Right. We'll start doing that.
You know, so listen, the new iPhones are such a that was the least interesting news.
I agree 100%. I agree 100%. In fact, I didn't even mean to get into the subject. I thought I'd leave it to our Apple shows. We have MacBreak Weekly, iOS Today. But I mean, you can't not talk about a new. One that the phones are arriving. People started getting their phones yesterday, or Friday rather, and watches, same thing.
The biggest news, I thought, around the iPhone was that reviewers are saying that the camera in the iPhone XS.
I love that. I love name. That. I'm going to use
That's
that.
That's hilarious.
They should have a special Johnny Ive. It should be the XS Ive. Anyway, so the camera is better than the 10, but not as good as the Pixel
2. Last year's Pixel.
Yes.
And in about a month, not even that long, October 9th, there's going to be Pixel 3.
How did Google make a better phone than Apple a year ago?
In general, I haven't personally, this is not my experience because I haven't tried it yet, but I love the Pixel 2 camera. I took a lot of my trip photos with that. But you saw Vlad Savov of The Verge and many others, Neil Patel, also of The Verge, many agreed that it's good. It's an improvement. It's a big improvement. I've seen some pictures that just blow me away from the new XS. the 10S. But Pixel, they're doing something that Pixel did last year, which is take multiple images, stack them,
yep,
and create HDRs out of them.
And I'm really excited for the upcoming Pixel phones because maybe they'll have a really amazing camera.
And Google has shown that you'd only need one lens. Right. Apple's, you know, part of their selling point is multiple lenses. I don't know what apparently everything about the Pixel 3 is already leaked out. Does it have more than one lens? I think it still has one lens, right? I can't remember.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
You live in the future. You probably already have one.
Yeah. What is it going to be the next year?
Well, can I just talk? For me, the biggest news from the Apple announcement was the double SIM card in China. And here's why I thought that was important, because, you know, that is a significant form factor change. That's a different kind of engineering that, you know, they've basically created a phone specifically for China's market, which tells us two things. One, it tells us that China is a big enough economic force that it can compel a company like Apple now to create an entirely different phone, which is sort of antithetical to Apple's culture and what it's done all of these years. But the other thing is that set in the context of the trade war and all of the different tariffs that are being thrown around, what's so interesting to me is that, you know, Apple essentially is large enough now that it can operate. I mean, it's got enough power and capital. You know, it effectively operates like its own nation state. And so Apple has managed to keep itself in China and outside of the skirmishes that are happening between Beijing and Washington, D.C., with a phone that's been created specifically for that market. So that tells us a bunch of things about, you know, what Apple sees as its growth potential for the future. It tells us something about China's influence and Apple's influence. To me, that was like the big story that didn't get enough attention.
Yeah. And of course, you're doing it in an interesting way, unlike other dual SIM phones. Is it only the Chinese model, or is it all models that have this capability?
No, it's just the China. Okay. Yeah. And there's, so I lived in China. Mike, did you live in China?
Nope.
I feel like you've lived everywhere.
I've been there, but haven't.
Okay. So there's a lot of people who have two different phone numbers and two different phones for many different reasons.
And dual SIM phones are really popular. And a lot of times it's because that's their only computer. That phone is their whole business.
But also their regions, not just in China, but in India and other places where it's not uncommon to go from one carrier to another, even in a short trip. Mm-hmm. So having multiple SIMs is practical.
I would love one because I would love
you
to
travel
have
a lot.
Google Fi in one of the SIM cards and then the regular East, you know, Apple SIM thing in the other.
Yeah.
That'd be great. I'd love that.
Yeah. The chance of Google Fi supporting an iPhone
I'm going to go to China and buy one.
Seems small. I just want to say.
Well, you can put a card into,
it becomes a T-Mobile phone.
Yeah,
at
basically.
At least in my experience.
But if you're abroad, it's the same. I believe it's the same.
Same.
You don't get the multiple carrier thing in the U.S. if you put a Google Fi SIM into an Apple device. But if you're abroad, I think you get most of the benefits.
That is something I can report back on, by the way, from my travels. You probably already experienced this, but it's really different what's happened with internet access. For instance, Europe now has a law that makes roaming universal throughout the EU.
Yeah.
So one SIM does it all. In fact, I was talking to somebody from the UK, which is, I think, Brexiting at the moment. But even then, they could buy a SIM from Three or somebody in the UK that works everywhere in Europe without roaming.
Yeah.
In effect,
right.
That's what our Google Fi SIM does. It acts as if it's just local.
Yep.
And I used, by the way, I used so much Google Fi as I was traveling that I got to that 6 gigabit limit where they say, okay, we're going to stop billing you now, which is great. I mean, I used a lot of data. I don't know if it was super fast, but it was fast
enough.
Don't you
love that message they give you?
Yeah.
They're like, you know what? You've used up all the things, so the rest of it is on us.
It's
so
on
we're
going
to pay for all of it.
So it never goes more than $60 a month for unlimited data.
Plus 20 for the monthly account, so it's $80.
Yeah. I also use T-Mobile, and I paid for T-Mobile has an international plan, which gives you 256 kilobits per second instead of 128 kilobits per second.
Speeds.
But actually, it's a difference, and it's enough that it's pretty usable. And even this was a cruise ship that had been built in the last 2 years, and it had pretty much better internet than I'd experienced on older ships. So it's getting, as you travel, ubiquitous internet is becoming more and more the thing at a reasonable price. And that's a nice improvement in general. I want to take a little break. When we come back, I've been gone a long time, and I don't know what the hell happened. So I have charged both Amy and Mike to tell me the big stories of the last 3 weeks. Amy's got two, Mike's got one. What were the stories that I missed? And then Karsten's pulled a few stories, and I even found a few, including one from a heart doctor that says, if you trust your life to the Apple Watch, you're nuts! we'll get to that in just a second. I have a little problem because I'm going to go home after the show, and I know my family's going to say, what's for dinner? See, I haven't gone 3 weeks. Thank goodness there's a Blue Apron awaiting me. Blue Apron is the number one meal delivery service in the nation. They deliver fresh, seasonally inspired, pre-portioned ingredients with the recipe. So you don't have to shop. You don't have to menu plan. You don't have to meal plan. They're seasonally inspired. They're always fresh. They're delicious. And what a range of recipes. I've been now, one of the things they're doing, which I really love, they have celebrity chefs, celebrity recipes. I was doing some Chrissy Teigen. I mean, she's a good cook. Whether you're looking for quick and easy meals or a full culinary cooking experience, Blue Apron lets you choose from a range of recipe options. I know our audience will love the Bob's Burger-inspired recipe collection. Crazy. These are great. And the Whole 30 approved recipes. How about crispy chicken tenders tonight? Mashed potatoes with butter, lettuce, and ranch dressing. Okay. Or they always have vegetarian options too. Pasta and creamy tomato sauce with summer vegetables. Blue Apron's really awesome. Every week we go, we pick, because you get a bunch to choose from. The recipes don't repeat very often, I think once a year at most, so you can always get something new and different and exciting. You're going to learn how to cook things like sweet and spicy udon noodles or cool, what is it? Oh, look at that. What was the other one next to that? Was that cod and coconut in a curry bowl? Man, see, if you want to go exotic, you can. That's the nice thing. It's your choice. You get to. They have kid-friendly recipes for the family plan. Check out this week's menu, and you'll get your first three meals free when you go to blueapron.com/twit. This is the step-by-step instructions. Very easy to do. blueapron.com/twit. Your first three meals on us. Great way to get started. And check out the, even if you know, just want to go and look at it, check out the recipes, the celebrity recipes, the Bob's Burger-inspired recipes. That is so much fun. blueapron.com/twit. I haven't decided what I'm cooking tonight, but I don't have to worry about it because I get home. It's all there. It's all ready.
It's much better than the Family Guy inspired recipes.
The Simpsons.
They're terrible. Yeah, the inspired. Simpsons, right? American cheese.
It's kind of donuts. Funny that Bob's Burgers has recipes, and they're great. They're hysterical, the burgers.
Some of those Bob's Burgers recipes on the show look really good.
Don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah, I need some of those burgers. Yeah, for sure.
Okay. I'll just mention this. I'm a heart doctor and wary of the new Apple Watch because I mentioned it going in, then we're going to get your stories that I may have missed. This is actually an interesting point. We talk a lot about Apple and their reality distortion field, their amazing marketing, and I celebrate that. Every company has to market. We have to market. Mm-hmm. That's fine. Where it gets problematic is where Apple starts to market to the detriment of people's health. Now, I think it's very interesting that one of the things Apple's doing in these new watches is you can do the AFib style EKG that Cardia and other companies are doing. It's FDA approved, but it's two terminals, right? One terminal is your wrist, one terminal is the knob, as opposed to a 12-terminal full EKG that you would get in the hospital. That means it is not as accurate. But more importantly, this physician, he's writing on Medium, Dr. Joe Mandrola says, even with the 12 sensor EKGs, we get about 10% false positives. And that's an issue because that means 10% of the time an irregular rhythm, which is normal. Everybody has, people have irregular rhythms, are falsely labeled as AFib. Mm-hmm. Which, means medication, means treatment, means serious. He has an issue, and I think a lot of physicians do, with testing a healthy population, just testing everybody if without indication that something should be tested.
He's wrong.
But that also cuts into a lot of...
He says when you endeavor to make healthy people healthier, you always risk making them worse.
Here's the thing, though. You cannot in the United States request diagnostics on your own. So I'm married to an eye doctor. So, one of the ways that every doctor, because of how our billing system is set up in the U.S., the way that they earn a living is through some of those diagnostics. Now, at the moment, you could make an argument that way too much data is not a good thing because there's no way to interpret it. On the other hand, if we don't continue, you know, the more, like, those diagnostics are important to do when you're healthy, not just when you're having a crisis, because it helps you set baselines. You can track trends over time, you know. And we don't have a system set up in the United States to do that without going into your doctor. So
the thing is that
it's a huge opening.
But there is a difference here, because now a consumer device is pretending or even accurately saying, we're going to do some diagnostics here. That means many millions more people will now get these tests.
But that, there's no harm in it. And the reason is that...
Well, that's the question, isn't there?
There isn't, because basically, first of all, my heart doesn't belong to my doctor. It belongs to my wife.
That's a good point.
and if I want to, if I want some help because I'm a geek to make the decision about whether I go to the doctor and say, you know what, I'm concerned about my heart, this is what this is for. Nobody's going to prescribe medication or treatment based on the Apple Watch.
Right.
Nobody. You still get hooked up to the big EKG.
Right.
So that's why there's no harm. It's simply a decision-making tool for people to decide whether to choose to go to the doctor or not go to the doctor, or in some cases choose to go to the emergency room or not. And I think that's... I don't see the harm in that. It seems
so
to me
you're saying, in a way, this is the medical industry saying we want to protect our monopoly.
That's what I'm saying.
They suffer a lot. Doctors, the medical profession, suffers a lot from people self-diagnosing, going on to WebMD and saying, you know what, I think I have, a wooden leg or something. You know, whatever it is that the people decide that they have, and then then they argue.
I saw it on the internet. This is definitely a wooden leg.
Exactly.
There are legitimate reasons to not want all of that testing, because, again, our system in the United States is not really set up to deal with all that data. On the other hand, we really only work on diagnostics in this country when people are sick.
Yeah.
And then we're really only dealing with people, you know, like, it's a very small percentage of the population. So the bigger picture that I think everybody's missing is what this portends. I mean, Apple is, you know, launching a clinic somewhere in... all of the big nine. It's all of the you know, Apple, Amazon, Google. You know, they are all getting into the health space. They are all launching different products. I mean, it's very, very likely that we are moving into a future in which we have a sort of single record that's probably owned by one of these companies that includes our health data, which has a lot of promise and will improve our lives in a lot of ways. But it also means that there's going to be cataclysmic change in the health and medical and pharmaceutical industries.
Well, it's a certainty. You know, it's a certainty that consumer devices will actually be connected in various ways to the medical system in a more reliable way. That's super, you know, and we're going to apply AI to that. That's going to be the biggest step forward for health, where AI will be able to say, you know what, this ECG passes all the tests, but you know what? Based on this, AI analysis, we determined that 45% of people who have this exact same pattern end up doing XYZ. It's going to be really fantastic. So this is basically just a baby step toward that inevitable future when we are going to be wired all the time. And this data will be available to our doctors, and there'll be we'll be relying on it a lot more. It might be 5 years, it might be 25 years, but we're going to get there.
Well, It's going to be closer than that. It's, you know, we already, like, all of the big companies have flooded the USP, the Patent and Trademark Office, with many, many different patents that describe earable device, you know, hearing devices that also collect biometrics, thin films that you would wear that also transmit information. You know, we're quickly on our path in that direction. The real challenge is that LabCorp, Quest, we're not really set up for the innovations that are coming.
The future is not evenly distributed. It's only a tiny percentage can afford or are aware of these devices. You mentioned, what is it? It's a Vic Gundotra's company, right? What is it?
Cardia.
Yeah, Cardia.
Kardia.
You could go out in Petaluma and accost people on the street and ask them if they've ever heard of that product, and I guarantee that 99% of them have never heard of it.
You know who uses one is somebody who has been diagnosed with AFib, which is Jeff Jarvis.
Yep.
And he went out and bought it. It's from AliveCor, AliveCor.com. Went out and bought it. It basically works the same way the Apple Watch does, except that you have a separate set of pads. It can work with an Android device as well.
Yeah.
And he's, from his point of view, it's a lifesaver because if he feels an irregularity or he wants to just make sure he's okay, if he's feeling poorly, he can get at least get a quick diagnosis that allows him then to send that to the doctor. And I have to say, if you've already been diagnosed, I could see the real value of that. But I also see the point that this heart doctor is making, that now millions of people, it's a hypochondriac's dream.
Yeah, well, or also the cure. I mean, a lot of people think, well, I think I either had a heart attack or it's the In-N-Out burger I just ate. I'm not sure. And then, you know, it can...
If I could just ask Siri.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. By the way, I am pissed off, and I don't know if this is true or not, but the NFL, I was watching the Niners game this morning, and the NFL ran an ad that said, hey, Shlomo, what are the scores in the NFL today? And my home hub pod went off and talked for 5 minutes about the scores. And I was miffed. That should be illegal.
Yeah. Wow.
I thought that that was an FCC.
It should be.
We have diagnostic devices in our homes that at one point were just as controversial as the Apple Watch. Thermometers.
That's a good point.
Thermometers first came out, you know, like...
I bet you're right. I bet when the thermometer first came out, doctors said, people should not be able to find out what their temperature is. It's just going to cause more calls.
No, but it was the same. I mean, obviously not at that point, but it was the same sentiment. So what we're butting up here against is change that puts... that empowers the masses and, you know, takes away some of the purview of a small... group of people, you know, previously who were the only ones allowed to get and gather that information. So it's just, we're in another period of transition. But we can certainly talk about the watch and about AFib and everything else, but this is a tiny sliver. I mean, every company now is working on a suite of products, including Apple. The watch is just a tiny piece of it.
Yeah.
As a journalist, I want a device that measures the caffeine content in my bloodstream. So I know, I better have another shot.
I can't talk about it yet, but I think soon I'll be able to talk about this ring, which I wore on the whole trip, that does do a lot of diagnostic stuff. You used a word. I like this word. Did you coin the word earable?
I think I did, but...
Hearable or earable?
Who can
earable.
Tell?
It's not a wearable.
I say earable.
Earable,
no, this is
which is a wearable in the ear. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The
ones that I've got right now respond. So I've got a very awesome set of wireless Bluetooth headphones that respond to gesture, touch, and speech. So I can, you know, but the one, all everything that I've seen that's coming also collects your biometric data for transmission to something like a health kit or, you know,
right.
Google's Calico or whatever.
This goes to HealthKit, but also this is interesting. I haven't seen this before. It's a two-way street. It takes from HealthKit as well. So I can't talk about it yet because the guy who's selling these, who created this, said we're not ready yet, but I'll be doing a review. But it gives you it says my readiness is low. Thank you.
The show?
Ready for what?
Readiness low.
Ready for everything.
Yeah.
What are you not ready for?
Anything. That's a good question.
He's not ready for the data.
Yesterday, it was take it easy. The day before, great work. Oh, my readiness was high.
Wow.
The day before, take it slow. The day before, balance is key.
That's when you were on the camel.
That's the camel. You saw the camel.
So like a digital ring.
What it's doing, I think what it's measuring is heart rate variability, which is, I'm told, a key indicator.
You were having fun, and the rest of us were struggling in the digital information mines. Did you hear that that Jack Dorsey published his heart rate through his based on
Twitter?
No, yeah, while he was in the Senate hearings, he said, "Well, here's
that's
they asked me this question and look at my heart."
Oh,
spike.
That's hysterical!
Isn't that amazing?
No, the hysterical part is that his resting heart rate like matches Lance Armstrong's. He's got like one and a half beats per minute. It's like a ridiculously low number.
Yeah, well, he looks like a meditator type guy.
I think when we should plot income against resting heart rate. Because I guarantee you, the more money you have, the better your resting heart rate is. I don't know why, but I just feel like there's a correlation. It feels like the rich are in better shape than the rest of us.
I also wanted to see Alex Jones's heart rate.
He does not look healthy.
No, he does not.
But maybe it's because he's apoplectically red all the time. I don't know, but he does not look healthy.
Did you watch to say something? I think I heard something.
Did it was it? Alex Jones.
People are talking all the time now. My house, everywhere I go. My poor wife, she said, there was something talking in your office, and I tried everything. I said, hey, hey, Amazon. I couldn't figure out which device was giving me that information. All right. I said, and I want to do this. I said I would ask you guys, what did I miss? This should be a new feature. I'm going to make this every week. Carson, let's do this every week. So now I don't have to read the tech news anymore. What did I miss this week, Mike Elgin?
Okay, so Elon Musk is going to launch a Japanese punk rock billionaire into space.
I saw that.
I
didn't know he was a punk rocker.
He's a punk rocker. He actually had a successful punk rock band.
Wow. Before he was a billionaire.
Then he launched a digital clothing company.
Yeah. Yusaku Maezawa. Am I saying that right, yeah. Amy?
Kind of, yeah.
Yusaku Maezawa. Anyway, so he's it's interesting because if you look back at the things we thought were important from like 15 years ago, oh my God, the Palm Pilot is the most, you know, they weren't that important. But launching tourists into space, this is a big change for what human beings do.
He didn't, by the way, just buy one seat. He bought the whole rocket.
He's an art fan. He's going to bring a bunch of artists, which, you know, into space, which, you know, I guess they're pleasant enough people, artists. But what was funny about during the press conference is that Elon Musk is like, he knows it's dangerous. He knows he's probably going to die. And he came to us. We didn't go to him. He came to us. So wait a minute,
probably going to die? I didn't hear that.
I'm exaggerating for comic effect. But basically, Elon Musk says he knows this is a very dangerous thing that he's doing.
He could die.
Right.
Yeah.
We'll still cash his check, but he could die.
He could take all the artists with him.
But to me, the idea, the ambition for a private company. You know, we've crept up to this moment because
this guy's got a lot of money.
And Blue Horizon and stuff.
He bought a Basquiat painting for $110 million.
Yeah, he's swimming in it. But the idea of launching tourists into lunar orbit is just might be the second biggest thing humanity's done other than landing on the moon and walking around playing golf. I mean, it's a big, big deal, and I think that's the biggest general news story of the week that you may or may not have missed.
All right.
Yes. And I hope he survives.
There was other Elon Musk news. Yeah. I'm sure.
It was pretty much all Elon Musk news while you're gone.
I think there's a lawsuit. There's all sorts of stuff going on. But
by the way, why don't we get weed and whiskey on the show? It's like...
What was that? He went on Joe Rogan's show and toked up?
I think it was peer pressure. He didn't want to look like a not cool guy.
Okay, I just want to say... We have never pressured anybody to smoke marijuana on this show.
Yeah, it's mostly edibles, right? So
we do offer a wide range of edibles in the commissary, but it's up to you.
You know who didn't like that segment are the people who were fired from Tesla because they didn't pass a drug test.
Oh, that's a good point.
They did not like that video.
That's actually a really good point.
And I think the shareholders maybe didn't like it so much either.
Yeah.
Was there a little bit of a pushback
from
the board?
It was a dip.
Tiny bit of a dump. There was a
drop. Stock went down. Yeah.
There was a reverse correlation between how low the stock is and how high.
How do you like this story? Funding secured. That was Elon's tweet about taking Tesla private. May become the two costliest words ever tweeted.
I don't know. I don't know if there's precedent for that. He tweeted it. It's not. I mean, this goes back to like how are we tweeting? How are we treating?
Yeah. What is Twitter?
Twitter as a platform, because it can't be in only some cases like. It can't be, as far as the SEC is concerned, certain tweets are held to a higher level of scrutiny. But as far as other federal agencies are concerned, they're not.
It can be demonstrated that the tweet changed the stock price.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem. Yeah. So,
and by the way, this is a criminal probe. Yeah. This is not just some slap on the wrist.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on with Elon. There's something going on behind the scenes.
Everybody should get off Twitter. That's number one. I know you two both love the Twitter, but...
No. Wait. I don't love the Twitter. Twitter is a utility that I use for certain things.
I see it as an occupational necessity because it's basically just journalists talking to each other.
Yeah. But then there are others who really are not doing themselves any favor.
The president, Elon Musk.
I think that Twitter's been very good for the president.
Oh, yeah.
Until his tweets are evidence in the court case.
All right. That was your story. You're going to stick with it.
I'm going to stick with it.
Amy betted before the show that she would not overlap with you, and I think Amy is not going to overlap with you. What did I miss this week?
So, well, actually, I've changed my other thing because it relates to what Mike said.
You have too many.
You could do more than one
if you want, Amy. It's okay.
All right. So the quick thing is a really wonderful show called The First, which is just launched on Hulu. It's by Bo Willimon, who was the showrunner for House of Cards, the first couple seasons. It's set in the year 2031, and it's about the first group of people ever to try to get to Mars. So it's not space tourism, but it is 100% space related, and it's about just the challenges that humans face trying to achieve these huge feats in space.
Okay, you had me until I saw that it stars Sean Penn.
Yeah. He's good in it. The show is terrific. I worked on it, so I...
Oh, this is the one you were the consultant on.
Yeah. So I created the year 2031.
Anything that keeps Sean Penn from writing any more novels, I think, is a good thing.
You know, he's a fine actor, so...
Anyhow, but it...
And
it
I'm
raises,
glad, you know, I paid for Hulu because of, the Handmaid's Tale, and I forgot to cancel, so I'm glad now that I have that.
Yeah.
Because I'll be able to watch this. Did it launch? Is it launching now?
Yeah, and it was the first time they put all the episodes out at once because it's binge-worthy.
Hallelujah.
But I will say this. A lot of people got confused and think that it actually takes place on Mars, and it doesn't. It takes place in the year 2031, and it's everything that leads up to everybody trying to get to Mars for the first time.
And in fact, the series, which is 8 episodes, ends as they're about to make the launch.
Yeah.
I hope that's not a spoiler.
It's not. It's not. It's good. It's really
all right,
good.
I will watch it tonight. I thought, I haven't watched TV in 3 weeks. What should I watch? So now I have something.
It is not like a super fast-paced Jack Ryan sort of, it's a slower moving. But anyhow, to Mike's excellent point about what it means to go to space for different reasons than we've gone before, and what that implies. I mean, it's really interesting stuff. So
the choice.
All right, but
my actual
most important story of the week was Amazon. Amazon launched a whole bunch of different products and services.
Everybody is
very fixated on this microwave, and somehow everybody has lost the sight of the bigger picture.
The clock.
And if you look at all of the other things that Amazon is engaged in, which has to do with, you know, AWS and securing larger government contracts for various things, you know, it is crystal clear that we are quickly moving into a near future scenario where we are living in an Amazon home, a Google home, or an Apple home.
And the Amazon home, because you can't mix.
That's correct, because they're not interoperable.
Yeah.
And from my vantage point, the Amazon home is likely to be most closely connected with government services. And so for people
really?
Who can't afford certain things, absolutely.
Why do you say
and
that?
I don't, this is not a bad thing, but I think it's highly likely that...
Why would government pick a winner?
Pardon me?
Why would government... pick a winner in this race?
Because the government at the moment can't manage, I mean, literally cannot manage. Have you heard all the nutso stories about housing or human services?
No, as I said, I've been off the grid for 3 weeks.
Well,
I'm starting to really appreciate it, by the way.
Yeah, no kidding. But it's like very, very clear to me that the three companies are vying not just to own our living room, but to power our lives and our lives as they, you know, if you treat the home as a sort of gigantic spatial computing environment, you know, and we are a part of that, the road ahead to me is very, very clear. And so the microwave is sort of silly, but cool. The clocks on the walls are silly, but interesting or whatever. And everybody needs to, it's fine to acknowledge these individual developments, but if we look from a 40,000 foot perspective, you know, like the pieces are starting to come together now.
What I saw was the CNBC report saying Amazon was going to announce it. Did they announce it?
Yeah, they announced a couple days ago. Lots and lots of products and services.
Okay.
So there's a device now that you can turn any car into a skeleton powered,
Well, I've had that, the ROAV from... But this is one that's officially... What I find interesting is that... Amazon has decided to make their own as opposed to license, because it looked like for a while their strategy was going to be, we're just going to put Echo everywhere. I won't say the A word, but Echo everywhere by licensing it and making it very easy for somebody to build something.
Well, they're also doing that, but they're producing. I mean, it is to me. I think everybody's when we think about the future and who's really building the future and who's really thinking. Elon Musk has certainly done some interesting and you know wonderful things, right? But for my money, Jeff Bezos.
Yeah.
For my money, if I think of like who alive today is the most visionary, is thinking the most long term, not 10 years into the future, but 80 years into the future, Bezos is at the very, very top of my list.
Just everybody with their own space program. So that's Musk, that's Bezos. If you have a space program, you're thinking about the future. By the way, I saw a really horrible movie last night that had an interesting point to it. It was Fahrenheit 451, the new one.
Yeah.
And it was
great book.
Awful movie.
Wonderful Ray Bradbury book.
The original movie was good, too.
And the original movie was pretty good.
This movie, not so much. But what was interesting about it is they modernized it in part by saying that the whole world as constructed, which is that everybody's happy because we burn all the books and get rid of all those hard drives.
Thinking is always bad for you.
That this began with the tech companies of that era. They said that the tech companies of that era partnered with the government to create this world. So essentially what you're talking about, Amy, is where we're going to be living in this Amazon world, this Apple world, or this Google world. This is the world of Fahrenheit 451.
This has always been the stuff, though, of science fiction, corporate governance, basically. Yeah. Giant corporations running the world, if not in actuality, at least in de facto.
I mean, it's good and it's bad, right? There's a way to look at this in an optimistic framing, and there's a way to look at this as a catastrophic framing. If we do not do something in the United States sometime very soon to bridge the divide, the wealth divide that our technology is creating, we're going to wind up in a really bad spot. So, you know, the government itself is not going to subsidize the technology or the development of it in a lot of ways. So if you live in an Amazon home or a Google home and some of those devices are, you know, and the services are being subsidized through the collection of your data and the mining and refining of your data, you know, that's a trade-off. And for some people, that may not be a big deal. And for other people, that may be,
are you,
you know,
familiar
too
with,
much.
With this book by Anand Giridharadas, Winner Take All? It's his thesis. I haven't read it yet because it came out just before I left. But his thesis is that this is exactly what's we've kind of done, which is say, look, government's failed us. Let's turn to the elite and especially to big tech companies and let them solve all the problems of the world. And I think we already have enough evidence that that's not going to work.
Yeah.
But he says that's kind of what's happening. He even says this is the election of President Trump is actually manifestation of that because it's the idea of, well, a business leader could probably solve our problems, right?
Yeah.
Because government
it's cyclical, though.
But he's doing a great job proving this
true. This has happened before?
Sure. I mean, in the 1910s to 1930s, we had big tech companies partnering with the government to develop, you know, computers and weapons.
Well, this is the opposite, though. This is, he says, all around us, the winners in our highly inequitable status quo, he's talking about the gulf between haves and have-nots, declare themselves partisans of change. They know the problem and they want to be part of the solution. Actually, they want to lead the search for solutions, and they believe their solutions deserve to be at the forefront of social change. You could say that with Mark Zuckerberg, right?
Yep.
You could say that with Larry Page and Sergey Brin at Google. You could say it with Jeff Bezos. I think Bezos is the least political of all of them. But
I disagree. I think he's just he's not in public as much.
He's extraordinarily disciplined about what he does in public. But
so we don't really know what he's up to.
It seems to me that a great number of societies have collapsed because of huge and growing inequality between the haves and have-nots. I could be wrong about that, but I think most of the major civilizations that have existed. And so I think that it.
Yeah, I guess you could say the merchants of Venice, for instance, declared themselves, because they had great wealth, declared themselves to be the future of the world, or the Romans or the Greeks.
I mean, if you look at even ancient Sparta, which the Spartan system that we know was essentially found, now we're really off the rails, was essentially a revolution that made everyone equal who was a citizen. And then over the next like 700, 800, 900 years, they evolved to the point where there was more and more inequality, and then the system fell apart because there was inequality. It was a direct result of they couldn't raise an army because you had to be wealthy to be in the army, and there was only like 30 wealthy people left.
It's a small army.
And they were really wealthy, but that's a small army, and they just kind of fizzled out.
So getting back
but
to
these, this is totally, it's relevant to tech, though.
Yeah,
it's relevant to technology because...
well, these are the elite that want to run the world now, or the tech elite.
Right. And so again, like the big nine, so my upcoming book is called The Big Nine, but there's nine companies that control the future of AI. Six are in the United States, three are in China. China's three, the Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent are very closely aligned with the government. And part of what's happening in China and why we see these tectonic shifts happening is because China is about to go through social mobility at a scale that's never been seen before in the existence of humanity.
Yeah.
The number of people in the middle class is going to balloon over the next decade, and they're going to move up. And so like part of the reason that China is in Africa is because China doesn't have enough wood to make the fancy, like this red colored wood that is very popular there. Like they don't have enough, wood to build the furniture that the newly wealthy people want to buy. So you get problems on both ends. You have problems when there's massive inequality, and then you also have problems when there's massive shifts in social mobility that all happen at the same time. And all of this involves the big tech companies. All of it does. So it's...
To me, the connection with technology is that the Bezoses and other billionaires like him, although he's currently the world's richest person, it's the use of technology and algorithms and AI and stuff to sort of take over everything. I mean, if you look at the rise of Amazon, he's used AI or something that could be considered a precursor to AI, essentially crushes competition. Famous diaper.com thing where he was underpricing their diapers like in real time until they had no valuation. Then he bought them for pennies on the dollar. Yeah. That's an example of how that's a direct link between somebody who's worth $130 billion or whatever it is now, and technology.
Yeah.
He's using technology to create this gap, this wealth gap.
So New Echo, I'm just looking now at the announcement. This was just a couple of days ago. It was on the 20th. You can go to Amazon now and pre-order some of these. New Echo Dot, which is, you know, sounds better, I guess, and is covered with fabric. So, you know.
Fabric was a big deal.
It's got that going for it. There's also a new Echo Plus, again, better sound, fabric. They're doing a 10-inch Echo Show. I really like the Echo Show. Everybody hated it, said it was ugly. You mentioned the microwave.
Right, which is voice activated. I mean, you can't like say a lot, you know, the A word.
I don't really have a lot
take
of,
a potato out of my
have
refrigerator
a lot of trouble. Putting something in the microwave, pressing a button, and it goes on.
Yeah. And it doesn't seem like that big of a deal.
Well,
why do I need to talk to my microwave?
They said
the user interface for the microwave is stuck in the 70s. Yeah.
So it depends how much microwaving do you do? This is a totally legit, like, microwaves have become overly complicated. The microwave in my mother-in-law's home, my in-laws just moved. They've got new technology in their house. And I can't even, that microwave's way overcomplicated. It's too many questions. Just like I just want to nuke something for 2 minutes and be done with it.
Maybe I have an old one because I have one where you put something and you close the door and you press the number 1 through 9. It zaps it for that many minutes. And generally, that's all I need.
That's all. That's correct. But they've overcomplicated
they got
a lot
more
of
now.
This.
Oh, yeah, because they're totally trying to say, well, is that a broccoli you just put in there? Well, I can cook broccoli in 12 different ways. Yeah, I don't want that, but that's what Echo's going to do too, right?
Or is it incremental benefits? So you're a microwave manufacturer. What do you do to get people to keep buying your microwave? So, you know, and there's some other issues like tactile functions. And if you're in a situation, it's easier for you to speak than to push the buttons, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I'm the wrong guy to talk to because I bought that $1,500 internet connected toaster oven. But I can't talk to it either. All right. So there's also the Echo Auto, which you talked about a little bit. That's, you know, there's a smart plug. $25 Echo smart plug.
A lot of these are just Amazon crushing little companies that are making things like smart plugs.
And the wall clock can be used to set timers and other time-based Echo tasks, which is what I already do.
Clock. half the use of an Amazon is in the kitchen to set timers. And so it actually becomes a timer.
Oh, wow. You never have to worry about daylight savings time. The motor will automatically change.
Isn't that pretty common?
There's a motor?
Bezos is pretty obsessed with clocks in general and time.
This has got to be a personal obsession. By the way, just so you know, the new budget eliminates WWV, the automatic time station, and the ability to have these automatic clocks set themselves to WWV. That signal's going away as well. So
when you say new budget, literally, what are you talking about?
The budget for NIST has been vastly cut.
Oh.
And among other things,
among
other things, but as a result, they're killing WWV next year, which is, I mean, I have a lot of clocks that are supposed to set themselves to the WWV.
We do too.
Do that anymore? I don't know what'll happen with this Echo wall clock, but it does have a motor. I'm just glad to see. You'll never have to worry. The motor will automatically change. Said some guy named Limp. I guess he was at the event. I don't know. He's also the guy who said the microwave was stuck in the 70s. I got to find out who this Limp fella is, because he's insightful.
Another thing that's really interesting that Amazon announced is an easy setup mode. Now, you appreciate this because of what you went through before the show with your Apple Watch, the setup. But now, basically, it's this really, it sounds like a great system where you bring in a new device, your device number 21, into your home that supports the A word, and it just sort of like, authenticates it and puts it online very quickly and easily. I think that's going to be a kind of a major thing from Amazon that everyone's going to copy.
There's a new guard mode, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
That will move all your devices into a security mode.
Yeah.
A lot of this is about nudging us to a different behavioral paradigm for the near future in which we are talking to we are talking rather than typing. And many millions of autonomous decisions being made on our behalf through those conversations.
And it's ubiquitous.
I think I have a different vision of all this. I think you guys are acting like this is all a clever plan. And I think they released the Echo and, whoa, people bought it.
Yeah.
So let's do 50 more Echoes and see what people will buy. I don't know how.
I would believe that if it was Google. I don't believe that with Amazon.
Jeff has
a secret plan.
He's
He's not in the public so much. People don't know his personality
so
much.
You don't see Jeff Bezos tweeting.
You don't. And I will tell you, do I believe that there is a grand plan and he has a singular vision that is, flexible on the details, but he is marching toward a future that he
it
sees?
It does seem like that,
absolutely,
doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I very, very, that's why with all of these sort of seemingly disparate devices, it may seem like, the Echo Show was a hit, therefore the smart speakers are in right now, and that's
cover
where they're making
fabric.
More of them.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think that's what's going on. I think that may be what's going on with some of these, with Google, for example. I do not at all for a moment think that's what's going on with Amazon. I think that they have
It was obvious that the Amazon Echo was going to launch a revolution. Super obvious. The week that launched, I wrote a column detailing exactly what would happen in the next few years.
I think
exactly what happened. We're moving to this paradigm you talked about.
But I keep hearing these stories like, well, Amazon Web Services, they didn't really. They thought, we have some extra computer time. Let's see what Amazon Prime. What do we charge? I don't know. Let's just try it and see what happens. Amazon Echo. You think that that's a disinformation strategy by Jeff Bezos, like pretend he doesn't know what he's doing?
As a member of the press, I know that when you approach them, they're a very different company to work with from their PR standpoint. I go to Amazon and say, hey, I'd love to talk to the person in charge of this initiative. I want to find out what your plans are, blah, blah, blah. And they're the most locked down. It's like talking to Kim Jong-un or something.
Smart.
Super self-serving.
I was in Seattle a couple of weeks ago at the Spheres. These are the somewhat contested, beautiful. It's part of their headquarters in Seattle. Yeah. Big spheres covered with 40,000 different species of plants.
Lots of fabric.
No.
Sorry.
Organic fabric.
This is part of Amazon's downtown effort. They want to put their campus in the middle of Seattle as opposed to Apple's campus, which is a fortress.
Lockdown.
Yeah.
You cannot go anywhere. And that's just a lounge space. And you cannot go anywhere in that. First of all, you can't even get into it unless you know somebody, which I do.
And that's what the announcement was.
You have to be tethered to that person. Otherwise, you know. And they will check.
When students tour Amazon Greenhouse, better not get left behind, right?
Right. They count the kids on their way out and make sure that...
Wow.
They actually do. They have a inventory system with their tags. Yeah. And they do count. They count and make sure that...
Seems like a humid place to have a meeting, though.
Can I
it?
Sneak in?
I would live in that place. Are you kidding me? It's
really?
It's like an enormous greenhouse with perfect weather all
it's
the time.
The
compared to Seattle? Oh, yeah.
Is it the biodome?
There's
kind of. They have good coffee inside. I mean...
there's where they went wrong.
They should have a coffee plantation instead of all the
good coffee inside.
So other things happen in the world of AI that was really interesting. One that's not getting a whole lot of play is that Salesforce came out with an AI voice first solution for Salesforce. It's going to come out. They didn't launch
now,
it.
How do we know that's just not a Me Too kind of,
it seemed
everybody's got one.
Ambitious, actually. It's got sort of Google Now style preemption where it'll say, hey, you know, you really need to call these customers because they're being neglected.
That's actually a good idea.
It's basically, you know, it's Salesforce is essentially a spreadsheet or a database, and they focused on taking natural language communication and parsing it into the correct fields. And then having preemption and communication so you can say, hey, you know, tell the group, blah, 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 and it'll go and it'll send them the resources they need. It, from what they've promised, it sounds significantly more visionary, I think, in terms of how the world will work in the future than the Amazon stuff. The Amazon stuff is like, oh, you can talk to the A word and you find out the weather and get a set of timer. This is like, okay, I'm partnering now with AI. When Elon Musk was baked out of his mind on the Joe Rogan podcast,
he had one puff.
Did you see the size of that? Anyway,
he barely inhaled.
Yeah, so he started. I mean, that
which
was
which is why the whole fallout is so bad. By the way,
but he made the point that
if he had inhaled, it would have been okay.
No, yeah, if he would have actually like smoked a bowl, I would like that would have been one thing. He barely took any.
Everyone's a critic. Anyway, so he was basically saying that what a corporation is a cybernetic organism between human intelligence and artificial intelligence, and the percentage of the artificial intelligence will only increase. He was talking about his whole anxiety about AI and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, it was an interesting perspective, and he said the only thing that's preventing us from being much more closely aligned and partnered with this growing AI is the interface. And voice is a major interface. And so this, for Salesforce, this is like an example of corporations eventually turning into these cybernetic organisms with this great interface. It's a great interface.
That's all. We built models showing that most of our conversation, 50% in the industrialized world of conversations that we have with machines, 50% of the interactions that we have with machines by the year 2022 will be with our voices. So Salesforce is just like the next company to jump on this. It's not really a bandwagon. It's a transition. Yep, yep, yep. I just want to go back to the Elon Musk thing with AI for a moment. So artificial intelligence is the third era of computing. It's not some other thing.
Yep.
And I think that Elon Musk is an incredibly smart person, and I think he's probably a very good engineer. I also don't think he fully understands AI, given what I've heard from, like, when he's talked about it. Mm-hmm. And his, you know, abject alarmist interpretations of AI, I think are not good for us all. So I just want to.
And you're writing the book, The Big Nine.
And I'm right. I wrote the book. It's in. It comes out in a couple months.
Oh, how
exciting. I'll send you a galley.
Well, you'll be on the show and we'll talk, of course, about it.
Is it just those
nine, though? I mean, can a company like Salesforce be a player?
Salesforce is a player. Uber is a player, but they are not building out the ecosystem. So
they'll use other people's stuff.
That's right. So, you know, they are locked into... in the United States, Amazon, Google, Apple, Microsoft, IBM, and Facebook. And I think that pool will shrink over time. And in China, it's the Bat. It's Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent.
I personally think the most interesting company in AI is Apple, because they use AI for the most trivial things. I mean, the way that AirPods work.
Yeah.
They use an AI to sync up the and so that the AirPods know if they're being held in your hand or they're in your ear or whether there's one in them or two and should they have stereo or it's like they use AI for the most minuscule little things, and I think that's so interesting.
But that's not that remarkable. Again, this is just the AI is not like a like the, that's just an example of autonomous decision making for singular purposes. So like every like it's not like
Isn't Apple even autonomous? I mean, it's really just an algorithm saying, well, based on these three inputs, you're holding it in your hand.
What's interesting about it?
How intelligent is that?
Yeah, it's not going to give us levitating cars and stuff like that. But it's what's interesting is every little thing is using some sort of something that could be considered AI.
I'm very interested. Leo just said something. I'd like to hear your definition, Amy, because I think a lot of stuff we call AI is just algorithm. What is?
And this is the So Leo just said something really, really smart, which is
what? Wait a minute. Let me write.
I know, right? It's crazy.
One point for natural intelligence.
I blame my watch.
So since we have, you know, AI has been in some form of development for 400 years, and in the modern era,
wait a minute, 400. Wait a minute. How could it be 400 years? You mean before computing?
Because if you go all the way back, there's a you could even go further back than that. There's always been a connection between mind and machine, and the notion of making decisions and performing tasks, and all of, you know, you can sort of draw a squiggly but pretty consistent line between Descartes and Hobbes and Jan LeCun, right, in the work that he's working on it on AI at Facebook. But here's the thing. So throughout this entire process, every time something that is within the umbrella of artificial narrow intelligence becomes so routine and part of our everyday lives, we no longer think of it as intelligent, right? At the heart of it, all AI really is a series of a system using data to make decisions. I mean, that's like the most basic explanation. And so the obviously the world of AI is far more sophisticated than that, but that's what we're really talking about. And it's the ways in which that data is used, the types of data, and the kinds of decisions that are being made and the actions that result. So,
okay.
And so for that reason, again, I think Amazon is the company. If you're watching AI, Apple is for me. Amazon is the company to watch, probably followed by Google, and then there's a drop off.
You have something I covet, and I want you to show us in a little bit, Amy Webb. She spent some money to get something fancy, and it's not an Apple Watch or an Apple iPhone. Mike Elgin is here. By the way, I turned a lot of people on during our trip to Digital Nomad.
Wonderful.
Because this is real travel.
Gastronomad.net.
That's it, not Digital Nomad. Yeah. Gastronomad. I always get it wrong. Gastronomad.net.
That's right.
Mike and his wife are putting together travel experiences around food. If you click the experiences button at gastronomad.net, you'll see some of the experiences. Your next one is?
We're doing Prosecco Hills, like our second Prosecco experience.
In Italy.
Next month.
Yep.
It's sold out. We still have a couple of slots left for Mexico City for New Year's Eve. That's going to be completely crazy.
Oh, I would love to do
that. Yeah. And Morocco experience, another Prosecco experience, and then Provence. And these are starting to fill up pretty quick. Maybe it's the people
that's
on your
good.
Boat. But these are fantastic experiences. We do the opposite of tourism. We do everything we do is exclusive to us and our group. And we get in there, we don't just taste wine, we make wine and we taste it. We go to the homes of the winemakers. It's a very personal, very fun. It's constant fun. And
that's such a great idea. And I'm thrilled that it's really taken off.
It really is.
A lot of repeat people.
A few. We had some people who signed up halfway through an experience.
They
signed up for the next one.
Yeah.
So we're increasing the number of people who are repeats. We have somebody who signed up for three in a row. Just boom, boom, boom. It's really.
Lisa and I better get on the list quick.
It's really resonating.
How big is each group?
Six to 10 people.
They're small, which is what I love.
Prosecco Hills is only six because we're in this 400-year-old farmhouse. They built it with the very first artificial intelligence 400 years ago.
you know what it was? They put the livestock on the bottom floor.
That's right.
And the heat rises and heats the entire building.
So intelligent.
So does the odor, but you're warm.
You know.
So yeah. That's better than nothing.
So our biggest one was Provence, which we had 10 people. But it's
really
they're
small
all
group.
Very small. Very small group.
It's highly curated.
Yes, highly curated. And it's
what fun.
It's all food all the time. And my wife is just a genius at finding these people and these visionaries.
You're selling out like this now. Yeah. It's fantastic.
So, you know, if you want to check it out, just check out the website and everything is explained there.
But, do you arrange all the travel and everything, or do they have to?
People arrange their own airfare. We pick them up at the airport, and between pick up and drop off, we take care of everything.
We're in charge.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that it's just like, this is what we love to do. It's like, we can't believe, you know, that we get to do this every time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so much fun for us.
This is an example of somebody who's found, you know, something that they love to do and found a way to make a living doing this. Yep. And it's got to be challenging because you're all over the world. I mean, it's impressive.
It's challenging for my wife.
Yeah,
Amira
is a brilliant cook. Yeah, one of the best cooks I've ever had the pleasure of.
But we go to a place and she'll be there for months planning these things. And then the thing is a week, you know. And so we really condense it. But she does almost all the planning.
Yeah.
And I do almost all the eating.
All the eating and drinking.
So, division of labor.
Amy Webb is also here. Her previous book, The Signals Are Talking, is available on Amazon and everywhere about becoming a futurist. Her new book is on AI. Comes out, you said, in a couple of months. I'm excited. That's great.
Comes out on March 5th and then launches at South by Southwest.
You can find out more about Amy and what she does at Future Today Institute. In fact, they put out a report every year of what the future is or something.
We have an annual report. It's in its 11th year on all the emerging tech trends you need to pay attention to for the following year. Last year we had like 175. We've already started putting together next year's report, which is I'm being told by the company that prints the books that it is larger than they would like for it to be.
I'm sorry, but the future is not getting smaller.
It's not.
The tech trends. So you can get the 2018 tech trends now at futuretodayinstitute.com. And you can, of course, keep an eye on Amy.
And I have to say that definitely I'm looking forward to the next book, but everybody should definitely read the last book. Signals Are Talking. Yeah. It's very good. Yeah. Love how you start. You started it has this sort of like neuromancer feel. And some
Akihabara. Yeah.
Sky was the color of a television. No, she didn't say that. But yeah, it's a very, very good book. Everyone really should read it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thanks.
Yep. Highly recommend it.
There is an audio version that I did not read, which is good.
Get it on Audible. Yeah. Our show today brought to you by WordPress. So I think I mentioned this. I certainly blogged it. I have discontinued my use of the evil trio, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, preferring instead to mail postcards.
But, I think that's so cool.
Oh, it was so much fun.
I really do.
Bill Atkinson's photo card app. And I mailed it to family and friends. But what I realized is that this also makes an excellent blog piece. So I'm putting my stuff on my WordPress blog. I love WordPress.com. It made it very easy for me, as easy to post to WordPress as it would be to put up a picture on Instagram or to even to tweet. It made it very easy for me to share my life and my travels. These are some pictures from Barcelona. There's my beautiful wife. We had so much fun. There's my pants. And it's and I'm putting the postcards up too. And WordPress is a great place to not only to host them, but to post them. And I really like the idea of, you know, you can keep your social media. I'm not saying get rid of your social media, but you ought to have a place on the internet that's your home.
I find it easier to follow you now.
I think so.
Because I get it via email and it goes right to the
You can subscribe to it. Yeah. You asked that on one of the comments.
Yeah.
And I did not reply, but there is a subscription link somewhere on there.
It's fantastic.
That's one of the things I like about WordPress. I was able to post this with very limited bandwidth from a boat, probably using cell phone, and get it out there, publish it. And that was really, really a lot of fun. I am such a fan. WordPress.com. If you're a business, if you're an individual, you really need to have your place, the place on the web that is you. And it's good to have a Facebook page or a Twitter account or an Instagram. You should probably do all of that. But it should all link back to your domain, right? That's what Google's going to show when somebody searches for your name, your business name. And it's so easy. WordPress takes care of the hosting, the security, the software updates. You focus on the content. And I use the WordPress apps on my phone or my iPad, which made it even easier. They have a great app. It was so simple to post this. It's just fantastic. Upload images, video, audio. And by the way, you, of course, you can link to YouTube or Twitter or Facebook, but when you put the images on your site, you own them. They're yours. They, you know, you're never going to lose them. You know, if Twitter closes down or closes your account, this lives on. And by the way, very easy to get data into and out of WordPress. I really like that. You can grow your audience and reach new customers with built-in search engine optimization, social media features. For instance, people can share my pictures on their Instagram or their Twitter or their Facebook. It's very easy with a simple button push. That way the world, you know, is helping you promote yourself. And you're going to get help from WordPress, 24/7 support, the best support team in the world. WordPress plans start at $4 a month. And there's a good reason. 31% of all websites, including mine, run on WordPress. 31%. It's the best. Right now, get 15% off any new plan purchase. Go to wordpress.com/twit to create your website. wordpress.com/twit. wordpress.com/twit. It was funny because these postcards are being mailed, right? And so there's four, I think, still to come.
Can I see one of those?
That haven't arrived yet. So at first I was putting them up on the WordPress blog, then I realized, well, that's not fair to the people I'm mailing them to. So I have to wait till they arrive, and then I will post the remaining postcards on the blog.
What service did you use?
This is Bill Atkinson, the guy who created HyperCard and most of the Macintosh software. He has, and I worry because I think people aren't using this. Bill said, yeah, it's a lot of work, and it's just not generating the traffic I thought, but it's called PhotoCard. It's an iOS app. And it makes these laminated, large laminated cards. It mails them, too. So I'm in Europe, and I didn't have to. It got mailed from the U.S. It costs about $1.50. That includes the postage. These are really good quality.
Yeah, super
printing.
High quality.
So, you could frame them or whatever. And I just, you know, I sent it to my mom, my kids, Lisa's parents, Lisa's sister. I sent one to work. Just as a way to kind of say, you know, in the past, I've put it on Instagram, and I think this is actually better.
Yeah, it gets lost in the mix on Instagram. And here, those are frameable. Those are really
I know, the quality is really good. And, you write on the back, you write a little stuff. I put it in a handwriting font, so it looks like I'm actually writing.
Now, you have to import the photos into your iPhone and then use
yes.
the up there. Okay.
So what the camera I use, and most cameras will do this, Canon does this, Panasonic does it, but the Sony software. It's really weird software, but it will import from the camera via Wi-Fi. So every night I'd get home, I'd copy everything over to the iPad. So I had all the access to all that stuff. Even though I had Lightroom, I didn't bother editing these yet.
Yeah.
But you know what? A good lens makes all the difference in the world. This is a really superb lens on a 42 megapixel full frame.
Do you ever play around with any of those lenses for mobile? Do you think those are worth it?
Well, so what happens when you start doing all that stuff is it degrades the image a little bit. So, because they're going to always opt for fast speed.
It also ruins the whole point of using your phone, which is to whip it out, take a picture, put it back in your pocket. If you have to take it out, like mount a lens.
That's what I find as I have. You mean the physical lenses you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm talking about the physical.
Those aren't very
good. I've had those.
I've had all of them.
What's the point, you know?
Yeah, there are some more expensive ones that are good. But yeah, what's the point?
Yeah.
And But I have to say, none of these were iPhone pictures. There are a few iPhone pictures on here, but almost all of these are with a good camera. And it's funny because I only brought one lens, so if I needed something a little more panoramic, I would actually whip out the Pixel or the iPhone. But anyway, it's a lot of fun. A lot of fun, and I don't miss Instagram. Lisa posted on Instagram, but... Mm-hmm. I'm putting these postcards. It's nice that his program lets you save an image of the postcard. So I saved the image.
And then post that as a blog post.
And post it as a blog post. But it's not editable text or anything. So that's the next thing I'm going to do is make it more accessible by putting the text as the, you know, when you hover over it.
You get the stamp and everything.
Yeah. You know what? The other thing he does is he lets you do custom stamps. So I use the, I'll zoom in on a little bit here. That's Columbus. So the city fathers of, this is in the Seville Cathedral, the city fathers of Seville were really terrified of Columbus, especially the king, because he became so powerful after he came back to Spain and enriched Spain and made it one of the great world powers. He was so powerful, they were terrified of him. So when he died, they shipped his body back to the New World. And he was, for a long time, he was in the Caribbean. And they finally brought him back a couple of hundred years ago, and they have his coffin. But people were worried, is it really Columbus? I mean, the bones have been rattled around all over the world. So a couple of years ago, they did a DNA analysis, and there's a couple of people still alive that are descendants of his. And they were able to verify that those are actually Christopher Columbus's bones.
Huh.
Now they're on your postcard.
And now they're on my...
It's a new world.
Have you ever been to the Seville Cathedral? It's the largest cathedral in the world.
I haven't.
It's stunning.
I haven't.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Stunning cathedral. You've been everywhere.
Been there. Seville is so great.
I loved Seville.
Yeah, it's so great. And it's they have a thing called the Seville Festival. It's a week or 2 weeks of just the most intense, overpowering Spanishness in your face all day. All the women
as long as there's
like,
jamón ibérico, yeah. I don't care.
And it's but that's a great city.
If you're a vegetarian, I apologize for that image because it's actually physically.
Does it all taste different? I mean, are the different? I've never eaten it before, so
it's all pretty darn good. The thing that makes it different is that pigs eat acorns.
Yeah,
they're acorns.
Oh. In general, the flesh that you consume in both Spain, Italy, and France is
similar,
significantly better than anywhere else. Mm. I think, like the beef in France, for some reason, is just so good. But
don't get me started.
One of these days, my dream, Leo, is to walk onto an airplane with one of those haunches, you know, with the leg, with the.
I wanted
see
one
if they take
so
it away.
Bad. I wanted to take one.
It's your support animal.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
That's brilliant.
That's right. It's my emotional support.
For it. It's okay. Great.
My emotional support ham.
That's exactly what it is.
So. I can't fly without a ham in the seat next
genius.
To me.
Genius.
Wow.
And then, like, dare them to tell you that if somebody can bring on a peacock, which is alive, that a dead animal is somehow worse.
I think you could bring it on the plane. I don't think it's the plane that's the problem. I think it's the Customs and Border Patrol. By the way, it is easy to get in the United States if you're an old white man.
Oh, yeah.
It's a snap. They just say, come on back. Welcome back. Just went through like that.
Yep.
I was all prepared to erase all my data and all that stuff. They said, no, Leo, you're an old white man. Come on in.
A lot of people
Here's
don't know this.
Here's your iPhone at XS.
A lot of people don't know this, but you can legally bring tons of cheese into the U.S. You can't bring meat.
You can bring cheese?
Cheese. Leo, it has to be.
Oh, I'd bring cheese.
It has to be vacuum sealed.
But you can cheese.
With a clear conscience, just bring huge wheels of Parmesan.
I guess the cheese lobby wasn't as good as the beef lobby. Nah,
exactly.
By the way, happy birthday. Today is the 10th anniversary of the announcement of this. Remember when the iPhone came out in 2007? Google does, because they had an Android phone ready to ship that just didn't look like an iPhone. They went crazy and went back to the drawing board and created this thing. This is the G1. It was on T-Mobile. I bought it right away. I remember Colleen Kelly, our engineering manager at the time, was a Google fanatic.
Yeah.
And she said, when that Google phone comes out, forget the iPhone. No, it was really underpowered. It had, look at that, those snaps up. It had a keyboard. But it was the first Android phone. I think it was running Cupcake, I think. Was it? Yeah, Cupcake.
It was the era of the Sidekick. The Sidekicks were so popular.
The screen is not significantly larger than the one on your wrist.
No, but there's one thing that Google was really prescient on. There's no headphone jack on this. they saw
they
the
called
future.
It.
They called it. They were the first.
Right. Oh, my God.
Pixel 3 will be coming out October 9th.
Does it not have a jack?
Does not have a jack.
For real?
The Pixel 2 didn't have a jack. No. And that's just, to me, slavish copying of Apple. And by the way, it doesn't have a jack, and it does have a notch.
That I cannot understand.
I understand.
Copying the notch.
Actually, I'm the other way around.
Where are you guys on the...
I understand the notch because you want to get this. You don't want any bezel, and you've got to put some cameras there. So that's fine. I can live with the notch. I don't understand the lack of a headphone jack. I think that that's insane. But I have to live with it. And everybody seems to be doing it. Apparently, according to Cas van Dinter, there is a fourth color in the source code. There's a line you only hear on geek shows. There's a fourth color in the source code, pink, for the Get Google Pixel 3. It'll also be available in pink.
What does it matter? Nobody can own a phone that doesn't have a case on it because they shatter if you
exactly.
You know, so what does it matter what color the phone is?
You're like my wife, because I said, what color do you want? She said, I don't care. I'm going to put it in a case.
Right.
So.
You guys have cases on your phones, right?
Yeah. You know what? Before I got the phone, I got the case.
Yeah, yeah.
It always comes first, and it gets me all excited. Yeah. Oh, there's a package from Apple on your desk, Leo. Oh, great. It's a case. Wow, that's exciting. Let's see. Oh, Google has suppressed a memo. This is according to The Intercept. Revealing plans to closely track search users in China.
Specifically, the search tool would be associated with a phone number so that they can, the Chinese government can know exactly who's searching for what.
Yeah, this isn't Google. Google doesn't care. They're doing this for the Chinese.
Yes. But they're... apparently, and this is part of the controversy which caused some...
Would store not only their number, but their movements.
Exactly. So this is a great tool for China's alarmingly growing surveillance state. China is really on the forefront of using advanced technology to surveil and monitor the population and control them and stuff like that. And this would be another example of that. And everyone is disappointed in this because Google is the one company you could point to that said, look, they left China on principle because they were hacked by the Chinese government, because the Chinese government wanted them to censor, et cetera. And they left. And so like everybody's like, oh, wow, Google's like a little bit better than other companies. But this report seems to indicate that maybe they've changed their tune and they don't want to be better than other companies.
Google did not respond to the Intercept story. Amy, last time you were on, we talked about the Chinese social credit system.
Sure. So, you know, again, like none of this should come as a shock to anybody.
Well, it's no shock that China wants to do it. It's a little disappointing that Google is helping them.
Right. But Google has had a presence in China for a very long time, as have Apple and Microsoft. And, you know, I mean, and the challenge is that, from my vantage point, a lot of this work in technology and the partnerships that we're trying to see and you know, skirting around the government in different ways, all of this plays very neatly into Xi Jinping's New World Order, plans for a New World Order in which China and China's special brand of communism has spread. And so all of these technologies and all of these devices and search. And, you know, the problem is that China is too lucrative. There's 780 million people who are wired, and that population is growing, and their social mobility is growing, and their economics are growing. I mean, it's too big for companies to ignore. So if you're a big tech titan, you want to capture part of that, part of that, you know, economy.
I guess it's completely Pollyanna-ish of me to say, well, gosh, I wish American companies would stand up to authoritarian companies and say we just aren't going to do business there because we believe in freedom. Is that too much to ask?
It's not too much. And the problem is that it's not a black and white issue. There's a line somewhere. There is a line. So if the Chinese government said to Apple, okay, in order for you to sell iPhones here, you have to like execute prisoners for us in a
that's
stadium.
That's a line we're not going to cross.
That's a line.
Obviously.
So, and then there are other things like, you know, Apple's willing to eliminate certain apps from the app store that the Chinese government, that's on the other end of the spectrum, a little bit more innocent. And then where is the line that's acceptable? There's a line there somewhere that's acceptable and unacceptable. Lots of
here's the problem. As soon as you say, well, we're going to do business in this country, then you are saying, and whatever the laws are of that country, we're going to adhere to them. Otherwise, we can't do business. That's why we celebrated Google's decision some years ago to essentially leave China.
But they didn't leave China. I mean,
instead of censoring search as China requested, they moved search offshore to Hong Kong, and there was no Google search in China. Yeah, admittedly, they had other stuff going on in China, but...
You know, we also ought not to be so Pollyanna-ish about our own government. I mean, listen, it's most people aren't plugged into what all the governments of the world are doing, you know, and we're heading into UN week. There's a lot that's happening right now. And, you know, in order for the geopolitical balance to remain as it is right now, which, you know, has Americans feeling comfortable, you know, we need certain kinds of technology. There have to be certain partnerships. The thing for me that's concerning about China specifically is that the surveillance is a piece of this, but the surveillance in effort for what? Like, what is the surveillance for? And the surveillance is not just to keep people in line. It's to help usher in this, this bigger idea of China's brand of communism. In the year 2049, that's the 100-year anniversary, and there's a lot of plans and strategic initiatives that are leading up to that. And there are all kinds of allies that they're building all around the world. So that data collection has a lot to do with seeing that new world order come to fruition. And like it, we may like this or not like it, but the big nine are all part of this.
Just to be clear, though, the word communism is a loaded term historically, and it's really Chinese Communist Party that enables this social control. But they're not actually that communist, and they're also not exporting their brand of communism in the way that the Soviet Union used to do.
It's
kind of a different thing. Yeah, they're dominating and exploiting
economically,
but they're not trying to get countries to like have a Chinese style of for the most part. I mean,
I disagree.
They have 68.
No,
go ahead. Finish, Amy. Go ahead. They had what?
There are 68 countries right now that are signed on to a pilot program that's part of a. I mean, this is very much about a very, very long-term plan.
It's interesting. This is something the United States has done for years. This kind of there was a book John Dvorak used to love to talk about, the Confessions of an Economic Hitman, mm-hmm. that talked about U.S. companies and U.S. government, with the help of U.S. government, going into nations and essentially destroying them, particularly in South America, by exporting American capitalism to these countries. And I that's exactly what China is doing. But there are reasons China is doing it beyond ideology. It's not an ideological.
I actually think part of it is. I think they very much see, and this hasn't changed since I lived there. They, you know, in Beijing, the CCP sees the United States and our democracy as counter to their interests. They see us as a viable economic partner, so we need each other. But this is about China spreading its geopolitical influence. I mean, they are monkeying around in the oceans that separate the mainland and Japan.
Yeah, they're building islands, slowly carving out territory, et cetera. Back to the technology, though. I think the one of the interesting things about it is that in many cases, the tech companies who sell their souls to do business in China, because there are so many consumers, et cetera, are ultimately disappointed. There's a few companies, American companies, who've done very well. KFC, for example, is doing very well in China.
I know. Boy, everywhere you go in Beijing, there's a Kentucky Fried Chicken.
And Apple's doing very well. Yeah. But like, I don't think Google will do all that well in China. I mean, there are
Because there's Baidu. Because there's...
Exactly. There are Chinese versions that, no matter how much Google sacrifices
but
Chinese
Google
government.
Doesn't need to do super well in China. Google doesn't need to beat Baidu in order... You know, a small gain in market share in China translates to a windfall of profit.
Right.
So they don't need to dominate.
And after all, if this Intercept story is true, and Google is building in this kind of tracking capability for the Chinese government into search, are they not, in effect, doing exactly where you said we should draw the line? Are they not helping the Chinese government, for instance, detect, follow, arrest, and eventually perhaps execute dissidents?
And if that's the case, well, yes, mostly.
We saw that happen with Yahoo.
But there are lots of Cisco is doing that. Lots of companies are doing that in China.
I know. Well, should we be doing that?
Personally, I think not. And back to the point of like whether it's worth it, I think the thing that Google should be more concerned about is losing business in the U.S. and Europe and Japan and other places that are going to be really horrified by them doing this kind of thing.
I don't think it's going to move the needle at all. I don't
I think
because
it could
we are too. We are maybe individual consumers will temporarily protest. I'm telling you, we are too tethered at the moment to Amazon, Apple, and Google for big companies. You know, we're too tethered to them. They control too much of the ecosystem that we all plug into. So it would be very, very difficult for a big company on principle to decide that they no longer want to work with Google as a result of Google's you know, building something maybe or maybe not for China. And quite frankly, I don't think people care that much in the, here in the United States. I don't. I mean, it's not a knock on Americans. I think we are focused on other things right now.
Yeah.
Speaking of other things, didn't you promise that she was going to reveal some crazy?
Let's see it. Amy Webb has something. I'm very jealous. First, she's going to take off her glasses. Does your husband, the ophthalmologist, approve of what you're about to do?
So, yes. Let me preface this by saying I have for a very long time been talking about this is the end. This is the beginning of the end of smartphones this year, and we're transitioning into what comes next. I believe what's next are smart glasses.
Totally agree.
And everybody who says
this guy was a glass hole before anybody else.
I was the biggest glass hole.
So for everybody, you know, so anyhow, for people who say I would never wear glasses, all of the data, there's all these studies out showing how quickly we are all becoming nearsighted because of the screens. And so with that being said,
that's, by the way, why Apple has introduced the iPhone XS Max.
Yeah, well, that's part of the reason why. So, so this headset, I've experimented with lots of different wearable devices and, you know, I had glass, I've had lots of different smart glasses. I've tried HoloLens. The only other experience that I can compare to the first time that I put on Magic Leap, which is what I'm about to do, was when I was living in Japan and I was in Akihabara and I saw a prototype phone that was connected to the internet. And I mean, seeing it was not that exciting, but at the, like from the interface standpoint,
you saw
knowing, I mean, it changed everything. Yeah. And so when I put these
this
on,
this is remarkable.
For the first time,
yeah. Now, Magic Leap, I was really, I maybe still am a little torn between classifying Magic Leap as the next big thing or as Theranos. I think that they have really, but now they've got a product.
No, listen, so this goes back to what I was saying earlier. This technology is so sophisticated.
For those who don't know, these are augmented reality glasses.
They're not.
They're mixed.
No. So this is the other thing. The founders, I think, have done some stupid things like promising to speak at a TED event, and they probably just didn't have something ready to show or talk about. So instead, they showed up in spacesuits and dance around for like seven minutes to freaky sounding music.
Well, and their website makes a promise that it might be a little hard to deliver on.
I disagree. The experience that I have now, I mean, at the moment, they don't do a ton, but what they can do has completely blown me away.
This is why I'm asking you, because I trust you.
Yeah, what does it do?
You've used HoloLens, right?
Yes.
Okay.
The difference is
Microsoft's version of this.
Right. This turns any space that you're in seconds into a spatial computing environment. So you do have to put the glasses on. They are not going to look like this forever.
No.
You are not going to have to carry a heavy pack around forever.
So that works completely untethered. You can use these without
you're tethered here, but the compute is happening in the cloud.
Yeah.
Or some of it. So, but you know, I map, for example, the room that I'm in, and the entire room then is turned into a spatial computing environment where for the moment, so I can see everybody just fine. I can connect to people in other cities and I can see them in the space where I'm in.
Now, why do you say this is not augmented reality? What's the difference between that reality?
Because AR is more of a two-dimensional, it's overlaying somebody else's images onto an existing space. This is interactive. So if I... because it responds to gesture, it responds to other elements. So if I, you can have little creatures and fish, like I turn my office into an aquarium for fun. and you can sort of push the fish out of the way and you're moving around and you can bring other people
in. You can
in.
Touch them. I mean, you don't feel it when your fingers, but when you move your hand in that space, it interacts with the thing.
Correct. And there's no lag. So there's a cognitive dissonance.
So it's doing hand tracking.
It must be, right?
It is. Yeah, it is.
Wow. So, okay, but what's happening is, you know, your brain gets tricked. I put these on my husband who we put a hole in the ground, a virtual hole. And he, you know, he knew that it was not real, but it looks real.
Yeah.
And he had a hard time walking toward
it. I've had that experience with virtual reality as well. Yeah. I mean, that's not.
So anyhow, here's what I would say. It is abundantly clear to me that, you know, this is quickly progressing. This headset, which is big and clunky right now, is the form factor is going to look more like glasses at some point.
Well, this is actually a light years ahead of the Google Glass experience, even of HoloLens.
If you look at the history of the development of this, the original one was the size of a car, basically.
But are they doing that, whatever that was that they wanted to do initially, that ray tracing thing, that this is, or is this more like just two screens? I mean,
No. Well, it's they were actually talking about retinal projection at some point. So this is, So, but here's what I would say. Nobody, we have to give these guys time. And I have no horse in this race at all. I'm not an investor. I don't know them personally. I'm just telling you that what I have currently seen absolutely blew me away. And I very rarely get blown away by new technology. And my concern is that if they don't suddenly have a bunch of apps and products in market and they don't have a consumer product ready right away, everybody's going to call them a failure. This technology is still a decade, you know, for it to really hit the mainstream and do things that are more than just playing games like what you're seeing right now.
I hate these demos.
Do things like import your grandmother into your living room and have a conversation with her or see real-time data. Like, here's a great implementation. Like, during the next like debate or congressional hearing, I've got my glasses on and every single time somebody speaks, I can see what PACs they've donated to. I can see who they have financial ties to. I mean, all of that stuff is on our near horizon, but we've got to give these guys time to work.
And that's actually an augmented reality feature, but overall, augmented reality is one of the things you can do. But one of the things that for skeptics out there,
I'm a skeptic.
Okay, skeptics. So you like regular? Look at this screen here. You have this big screen. It's beautiful. It's physical. Yeah. It's there. Okay. The most banal usage for Magic Leap is one that we can all relate to. Imagine a world where screens of any size were free. How many would you have? Where would you put them?
Well, look at my office. I have about 20 of them.
Right. But they weren't free. They're expensive.
Where I'm sitting right now, I actually put six screens. So I have a vertical monitor on one side.
Yeah.
And a horizontal monitor.
There's a huge difference. Here's the difference. Those screens are outside your sensorium, and you move around independently of them. You put them on your face. This is another virtual reality experience where people got excited about virtual reality until they did it for any length of time.
The difference is if you put it on the wall and then you leave the room, it stays in the room behind you just like a physical screen. It's there when you come back in the room.
It just gives me a headache.
Right. VR should give you a headache because the technology has not progressed enough so that we've solved for lag. And VR has very, very, very limited use cases. So VR works for games and it works for certain types of, you know, storytelling like a movie. It does not work for most other things. It's got a therapeutic use. But it came to market first. And so the problem is that we've conflated and we've had, you know, the first AR apps came out immediately after the first iPhone launched. So there was something called Retour, which was an early days AR app to help you get around the city of Paris. So, you know, and then Google Glass came out and it should never have been marketed as a consumer device. And they, you know, they had all kinds of PR problems. The underlying technology was interesting. But they're different things.
One of the things that this technology will do is it'll bring us back to a world of superstition and ghosts and things like that because there's already a company.
Oh, great.
There's already a company in Japan where you can have a virtual version of the people at the gravesite or potentially at the place where they were killed in a highway or something where we put on the goggles, you see them standing there waving. The difference psychologically between that and a ghost is zero. That's essentially what a ghost is.
But in Japan, there's a different company. I haven't heard of what you're talking about, but there is another company that has built an interactive horror experience. So if you're really into like haunted houses and scary movies, it turns wherever you are into a spatial computing environment and there's sensory and haptic. I feel like the Sony CSL is a piece of this, but it puts the horror all around you. So there are some entertainment purposes.
Kind of like this show.
these these glass, I'm telling you, these glass, there's, the, I can see these being a productivity element if you're a manager in an office and being able to sort of create a visual map very clearly of whatever it is that you're trying to track. I mean, I cannot say enough that this headset is hard to wear. It kind of sort of comes in and out. Kind, you know, I've got pretty bad vision, so sometimes it auto corrects me, sometimes it doesn't. And at the moment, there's not a ton that you can do. But what I can do, I can clearly see the future. And if everybody would just give these guys a break and let them work,
well, let's
and
talk
stop
about
expecting
the future.
A product.
5 years from now, this technology will be mainstream. There'll be two or three basic kinds. There'll be the Magic Leap HoloLens types, which will be for work or for high-end entertainment or for serious uses. Kind of like how we use high-end PCs now. We can use them for high-end gaming, high-end business, whatever. There will be the glasses that will look just like the glasses that Amy's wearing right now, which won't be detectable as AR glasses, but they'll be AR. We'll walk around. We'll see little screens. They'll be 2D. We won't have mapping to the walls right away. And then the third type, which is already available, which is, I think, kind of cool, is bone conduction audio, where you talk to the A word or you talk to Siri, whatever. But you do that all day. The benefit of that is 2-3-4 day battery life, and also you don't have things in your ears all the time. But this is happening imminently. I think this kind of thing is going to be super mainstream.
But I think that's a little aggressive. The glasses are definitely a decade out, just for a variety of reasons. But you can actually see, so they play a big role in the first. So if you watch that show, you'll see everybody wearing the glasses that we're talking about and some kind of earbud or bone conducting device so that they can talk.
I can see.
Leo, you should try them. You should try. Have you?
I almost bought them, but then I thought, oh, Amy will buy them. And
well, you're not going to use them. I mean, there's no reason to buy them right now. Yeah. There really isn't.
They're more than 2,000. They're like $2,500, right?
They're expensive. And unless you're built, like I'm building stuff and trying
you need
things
them.
Out.
You need them.
But nobody else should buy them at the moment because you can't do very much. But you should at least put a set on and just, I mean,
I'm willing to stipulate that. You know, somebody, I think it was, I can't remember who, maybe Annie Anako said, look, remember when you first got, you know, the Atari video console system and how primitive those games are? You know, we're at that stage. And I'm willing to stipulate that we're at a very, very, very early stage. Yep. And what you see today is primitive. I think, though, there's a more fun, I've in the past said, oh, it'd be really great to have reputation scores over people's heads or... Yeah. I'm not convinced. I mean, you could have said, well, before the Echo came out, well, you're never going to talk. Would you ever talk to your house? No, that's silly. But I've found some use cases for that. Eventually, you get hooked on it, and you have to have it. And I guess that's the case with this. But it's hard for me to imagine a scenario where this would be a must-have technology, I guess.
Well, but it's easy to imagine that they'd be addictive.
Yeah, I could see it being addictive. But, I mean, being able to talk to my grandma... I mean, I can do that with FaceTime.
There's a couple of accelerants that are, first of all, over the next couple of decades, everybody in an industrialized nation is going to need glasses much sooner and at a greater scale than we've ever needed before.
And your husband is happy.
Of course he's happy. So that's an accelerant that will cause the adoption rate to spike because we've already got something.
Well, I already wear spectacles all the time, so that's not a big deal for me. I mean, wasn't a disadvantage. You wear spectacles, but I'm willing to say, yeah, people get used to that.
Right. So now if you go back to, let's say 10 years ago, you know, I know a ton of people who would have said, I don't want to see somebody when I talk to the phone. When I talk to them on the phone, I don't want to see them. That's, you know, it's just voice is fine. I feel weird seeing video. And our adoption rate, you know, changed.
Took a while for that, but
took a little while. But there is what I think that part, you know, one of the things that's fundamental to human nature, regardless of where in the world we live or what nationality we are, culture, gender, anything else, is a need for intimacy. And part of why we adopt certain technologies faster has to do with fulfilling that need for intimacy that we have and that feeling of closeness. So just as an example, when VR, you know, we've been hearing about social isolationism for a very long time and how all this new technology, VR, AR, AI is going to spread us all apart. we're actually seeing the opposite happening in lots of different places. So video game arcades are back. They are popping up all over the place because they're mixed reality and VR arcades where you can go in and wire into stuff that you couldn't afford on your own. We're seeing silent discos. Have you guys been to one?
Yeah, they're hilarious.
So you have headphones on and there's four different DJs all playing at the same time. And you can be with other people in the same place, having an experience that's good for you, but you still have that level of intimacy.
It's so funny because
Bluetooth headsets.
Everything you just described to me is a faux intimacy. And I think some of the backlash against social media is we thought that that was going to be intimacy and that was going to satisfy that. And it's a faux intimacy that is actually like fake sugar poisoning our systems.
Or is it fake or is it different?
Fake sugar is.
Well, that's a good question, Amy. Maybe my kids will consider it real intimacy, but...
Well, no, because like just as for the, going back to the club thing for a minute, like I don't like... I used to go out when I lived in, like I used to, when I was younger in my youth, I used to go out to clubs and go dancing. I usually hated the music that was being played and I sort of forced myself because I wanted to hang out with my friends.
But are you hanging out with your friends when you got headphones on?
Everybody's got headphones on. And the cool thing is
that
a lot of
you're not talking or interacting with your friends.
Well, at a club, if you're dancing with people, you can't, I mean, you can't hear them anyways, but you can see they're color banded. So depending on which DJ you're tuned to,
see if you're dancing with
you can
same.
Find your tribe.
Yeah.
I think it's intimacy expressed in a different way. I think there's plenty of, to your excellent point, there are like plenty of ways this goes bad and it's faux intimacy. But I think some of this is just change.
I understand that. And what we consider, you know, an old people like me consider intimacy is different than you young people. But I think there, when you talk about biological needs, those things are hardwired. Those aren't going to change. And that real intimacy is hardwired. I don't think you can say technology is going to create a new form of intimacy. It's either intimacy or it's not.
Yeah.
Who knows? So we don't know. And I acknowledge it could be different.
I mean, this is a subtle driver. I mean, if you look at just podcasting, why is podcasting better than television or radio? No offense, because I know you also do radio. But
it is radio. That's the funny thing.
Yeah.
This is radio.
But in general, podcasting...
This is actually a medium that started in the 20s.
Yeah. But in general,
well,
podcasting,
but the difference
if it's
is
different,
that it's time shifted.
If it's different, it's more intimate.
You
than
can
radio.
Time shift it if
well,
you choose.
But that's important because that is, for me, that is a way to make this experience. I'm having... it's a way to personalize that experience. And I
feel like we have a world that's being invented by introverts for introverts.
As an introvert, I think that's fantastic.
I think the three of us are introverts and are all going, this is great.
This works out very well for us.
But maybe not necessarily biologically a trend.
I may have a different viewpoint on this because I lived by myself overseas for many, many, many years. And,
You missed your grandma.
If I were to do that, pardon me?
You missed your grandma. It would have been great to have a
hologram. I missed everybody. I mean, I was, it's like I missed a lot of things. And if I had the opportunity to be in my house and have on a pair of something like a Magic Leap and have a conversation with two or three of my friends and be able to see them moving around versus just squares on a two-dimensional screen, I think for me that gives me a better, like when I've played a multiplayer game with Leap, you do have this, I mean, it's Mike, you kind of nailed it. Talking about ghosts, but it's a ghost in a different way, and you do feel more. I felt more connected because I don't know. There's an additional element of movement.
So that's the real question. I think ultimately is going to be, is that satisfying? Is it real intimacy, or is it tricking our mind into thinking we're not alone when we really are alone? And that'll be interesting to watch that play out. I don't know what the answer is to
that. Word alone is a good word because you kind of like you don't feel as alone.
Right.
Even though you're the only person in that space and you can see it, you know, you see everything.
Yeah.
You just also see, you know, because you're in a spatial computing environment, you see other stuff.
Yeah.
It's really, I keep bumping into the microphone because I'm so excited. it's really interesting and... Leo, you should at least try them on at some point.
I don't know when I went from being somebody who embraced all and everything new to a Luddite, but
I don't embrace anything. Most of the time, see stuff and I'm like this iPhone,
skeptical.
Like,
yeah.
Again, like I'm this headset is you're not going to buy and do anything with it, but this is not what I'm excited about. What I'm excited is, you know, and that's why I want everybody to just leave them alone and let them like let's curb our expectations here for an annual product launch and just let them do their work. It's really hard stuff.
Well, the only people you have to convince that of is their investors. And I think that their investors, it's actually been a fascinating story because the journalists like Kevin Kelly and the investors who have seen this before anybody else has are completely sold on it.
Yeah.
And the rest of the world like me is saying, well, really? And but the Magically has as much time as its investors want to give it, right?
But they're colored by, but this is true of any technology, that the tech journalists, and part of being a, you know, social media is, I think, forced some of this, but there's an awful lot of snark. Like, yeah. I know very few tech journalists who can talk about Magic Leap in any way without also feeling an obligation to be snarky about it. And, you know, they are building something that we have not seen before, you know, again, I just and there's plenty of magic also happening at Google and at Amazon and at lots of Salesforce, lots of different places. We just have to somehow extract ourselves from this idea that there must be a product that conforms to a 12-month calendar.
Oh yeah,
otherwise they have failed.
There is a
very American thing to do.
There's a distinction between snark and skepticism.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
And I would hope that I'm not snarky, but I'm skeptical.
Totally.
Right. No, I think you're right. And I think there is intense pressure, and it is also from the markets and from investors to produce.
A lot of tech journalists get confused about what they're covering, whether they're covering the stock market or whether they're covering the actual hardware and software.
That's
whether
a big problem.
And the thing that Amy and I both, if we have one thing in common, is that we are obsessed with the cultural effects of technology, which is everything.
Right.
And the technology itself is really not that important, at least to me. And so when you're snarky about Magic Leap, essentially you're getting confused about what's happening. What you should be focused on is how is this going to change human life? Not like, oh, this isn't that much better than the HoloLens thing I saw a year ago. That doesn't matter how much better it is than it was.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter. That's an inconsequential observation.
It's an interesting problem also because companies have to decide what they're going to work on. Individuals, people, entrepreneurs have to decide what they're going to work on. And they're, of course, very much influenced. They can't help it, but the environment around them, the snarky tech press, the science fiction that they read. There's no accident that almost everything new and exciting is basically science fiction.
Yeah.
People are
That's why, and if you guys... Honestly, some of the best sci-fi that I've ever read was not sci-fi, and hopefully it's not fi at all. It's the patents. There are several Magic Leap patents that describe in a William Gibson-esque sort of way what this technology ultimately becomes. They are fascinating. Anybody that wants to can go onto the USPTO.gov website, just type in keyword Magic Leap, and just start looking. I mean, a lot of the patents are very long, and obviously they're technical in nature, but there are, in many of them, there are chunks where it reads like a science fiction novel. And, you know, it doesn't, just because they've described it doesn't mean that it necessarily happens or it happens on a time frame that you agree with.
Right.
But it is totally worth your time. It's like worth an hour of your time to just, you know, go through the USPTO.
Well, and also it would behoove me to point out that there are reasons, many reasons people make patent applications. And one of them is preemptively to hope that they're going to patent something that somebody someday is going to invent so they can sue them.
There's also an irony about reading about the future on a website that looks like it's from the 90s.
Yeah, I know.
God, that website. I wish they would do something about that. It's a bear.
Only Amy Webb is doing this. Oh, let me peruse the USPTO.
Anybody who's interested in the future, honestly, like you can put a couple of keyword searches in the USPTO.
Yeah.
And they'll send you emails of like any new patent that's been filed that mentions whatever it is. It's just a good way to stay on top of things.
How about a mixed reality system with virtual content warping? I want one of those. And a method of generating virtual content using SAME. Techniques for improving a fiber scanning system. These are all Magic Leap patents. You know, and I know investors look at these and just count them and go, that's good. Right. I'm going to buy this company.
Worst case scenario, we sell the patents.
That's right. They got 132 patents. Yeah. All right. Let's take a break. I actually have the stories that made my eyeballs go, what, when I came back. And I'm going to give you a few of those. But first, I would like to tell you about a new show that we're, well, it's not a new show, but a new edition of a show we've been doing for a long time called Know How. When Father Robert left, we decided we were going to kind of take turns doing Know How. Megan Maroney did a whole series with Florence Ion on IoT, and we've got a new series coming up with Jason Howell, but I'll let him tell you all about it.
Hey, I'm Jason Howell, and I'm here to tell you all about the next season of Know How. You already know Megan Maroney and Florence Ion are wrapping up their excellent season on the Internet of Things, and now it's going to be my turn to spend a few months focused on an entirely different facet of technology, and I figured, if given the choice, why not choose something really fun? And that's exactly what we've done with Know How Gaming. The always awesome Sam Moskovich from Ars Technica will join me each week as we dive into a number of important gaming topics, including console tips and tricks, virtual reality, live broadcasting gameplay, mobile gaming, classic gaming, console hacking, and even a holiday gift guide. We're covering it all leading up to the new year, and we hope you'll be along for the ride. Subscribe to Know How, if you haven't already, at twit.tv, and you'll get the gaming season delivered automatically each and every week, starting Thursday, September 27th. We'll see you then.
Jason Howell, twit.tv/KH.
That looks awesome.
Twit.tv/KH to subscribe to Know How, the gaming edition. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Let's talk about the future. The future is interest rates are going up, aren't they? And that means when you go out to buy that new home, you're going to be paying a little bit more, maybe not right up front, but over time. In fact, a quarter point in interest rates going up, thousands of dollars, maybe tens of thousands of dollars over the 30-year loan. That's why Rocket Mortgage has decided to do something special to take some of the anxiety out of home shopping. They call it the power buying process. Three steps that will make home buying a pleasure. First of all, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2. That's twit the number two. And answer a few questions. You could do this, by the way. It's so easy to do. You could do this not only on your home computer, but on your phone while you're at an open house. Or just do it now. Set up the account. Answer a few simple questions. They'll check your credit for pre-qualified approval. They'll do that within just a few minutes. That's enough to get you started. Within 24 hours, though, they will then verify your income, your assets, and your credit. All of this without any effort on your part, no 20-page application, no going to the attic to find paperwork. They'll do it all for you and give you a verified approval within 24 hours. Now, that means you have the strength of a cash buyer. When you're buying that house, you're good for it. You're good for the money. The seller loves that. They say, oh, good, they got the loan approved. In fact, you can even get a nice little approval letter you can print out if you want to show them. It makes a big difference. But here's the best part. Once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. And this is one of the things that really takes the anxiety out. With Rate Shield approval, they'll lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. If the rates go up, nope, your rate stays the same. If rates go down, your rate will drop. But either way, you win. It's exactly what you'd expect from a company that's focused on its customers. Number one in customer satisfaction, 8 years in a row, according to J.D. Power. It's Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2. Just take, you know, it's enough. You're writing a big check. You're buying a house. It's a big deal as it is. Let's not make it any more anxiety-ridden. Go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2 for Rate Shield approval. Only valid in certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. It's rocketmortgage.com/twit and the number two, rocketmortgage.com/twit2. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for being such a great supporter throughout the year. And they're coming back next year, and we're glad to hear that, too. We're going to get back to the tech news in a minute. Of course, while I was away, the shows go on, thanks to our great hosts. And if you missed anything, as I did, I'm looking forward to watching this. We've got a little movie talking about this week on Twit.
Previously on Twit.
You're filling in for Leo one more day.
Yes. My fear is that Leo is literally going to come into the studio while I'm on with the last hour of the tech guy and just literally grab the microphone for me. This is the dream I've been having at night. It's like the nightmare.
Maybe that might actually happen.
Now that you put it out into the world. Did he mention it in the postcard? Let me see. Yes. Did he mention I will be kicking you out?
Mac Break Weekly.
Someone posted stats to show that the iPhone processors now are about as fast as some of the, you know, are getting very close to the fast as some of the bottom end MacBooks. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. You know, I think that so you're looking at stats there and speeds and capacity that is starting to the MacBook Pro 13 not being possibly that much more powerful, and probably by A13, A14, we're probably going to see a point where, you know, you are buying a computer.
This Week in Google.
So Smart Replies, you know, looks at all these responses and makes up a response that you should give an email. And I've talked about how I feel guilty using it. Well, AI goes off our behavior. So guess what Smart Reply tried to get people to say often? I love you.
Oh, I'm down with that.
Yeah.
You know, all this hate going around in this world, plant that little seed of love. I totally dig that.
Twit, we love you.
Don't tell Rich that I'm going to kick him out in the last hour. Now that you put it out in the world, it's probably going to happen.
Well, then I'd also like $1 million.
Okay, good. That was important to fit that in there.
Let's put that one out there in the world, too.
Twit continues the return of Leo after 3 weeks. Mike Elgin and Amy Webb with me today.
You mentioned the new Jason Howell gaming know-how. You didn't mention Valley of Genius, which I think is
Have
a podcast.
It's
fantastic. So good. So good. Such
that
a great idea.
That is a
idea.
New show, too, and I didn't really publicize that as much as I should have. It's audio only. It started because we interviewed the author of the book, Valley of Genius, and on triangulation. I'm talking to him. It's a great book. Adam Fisher talked to hundreds of people who made Silicon Valley what it is, and I mean hundreds. And at the end of the conversation, triangulation, he said, yeah, I got many, many hundreds of hours of tape. I said, what? You have audio of all this? Yeah. I said, you know,
oh wow,
a book was a good idea, but I think a podcast might be better.
Yes.
So what we've done is we've just, and they're not long. I think they're 15 minutes, half
That's
an hour.
That's really smart.
Yeah. We've got Woz.
Yeah.
We've got the third founder of Google. You know, everybody talks about Sergey Brin and Larry Page. But there was a guy, what's his name, Adam Hassan, who did all the coding. He was the fifth Beatle. He did all the coding for Google. He was a graduate student at Stanford who had been assigned. He was the only programmer in the computer lab. He was assigned to all these graduate students that are trying to write their thesis to code up the thing their thesis is about. Larry and Sergey were just trying to get their doctorate.
Right.
They didn't. So this whole thing, Hassan's writing the code for it. So that's one of the interviews. There's Nolan Bushnell. He even followed Tony Fadell, the guy who worked on the
iPod.
He was originally at General Magic. Mm-hmm. Great story there about how he got the job at General Magic as a kid straight out of college. He then went to help design the iPod and the iPhone. Fadell is now in Paris, as anybody would be with his money.
That's where I would be.
And and actually, he's helping entrepreneurs. He's doing VC stuff. So they're great story. Adam gets on a motorcycle or a bicycle, I guess, because they're bicycling across Paris. He's following Fidel across Paris. This interview, wait till you hear it. The audio is fantastic. So he has audio of all of this stuff. I said, Adam, come in. Let's do a podcast. So that's Valley of Genius, twit.tv/VOG. It is only audio. Because there's no, what do you need video? We could put new episodes out every Monday. And this could go on for a long time.
If somebody came to you and said, I'm going to interview this guy, I'm going to interview that guy, you'd be like, sure you will.
He got everybody.
It's unbelievable. They're not performances. And this is the great thing. As a journalist, you interview people and the interviews are actually great, but you usually don't get to, nobody hears them, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's basically
his notes.
He
needs to go back and ask everybody if it was okay that he...
Well, I asked him that. He said, well, there's this thing called the First Amendment, or I don't know what he said. Yeah. He said, basically, this was on the record interviews that we were doing for a book. Didn't, you know, I own them. Huh. He's interviewing Woz. What's the name of it? The Chuck Wagon? Woz loves this place.
Barbecue place, right?
Yeah, he loves this place in Silicon Valley. What's it called?
The Hickory Pit.
Hickory Pit, right.
I like the Chuck Wagon better.
Are you sure it's not the Chuck Wagon? Anyway, The Hickory Pit's a chain, but I think there's, anyway.
You hear Waz lip smacking. And
they're eating, there's clanking of dishes. It's really fun. Yes. No, he didn't. He says, I said, you have permission. He said, oh, yeah, these are all on the record interviews. Yeah. I have permission to use these. So a podcast was born.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
I love it.
If you haven't heard it, twit.tv/VOG. And I think we've only done a few episodes, right? Carson, how many are out?
Two are out so far. One more comes out tomorrow with Nolan Bushnell.
Oh, that'll be fun. Nolan's the guy who hired a young Steve Jobs to work at Atari.
Yep.
And
still regrets it.
Any of those geniuses women?
Yes, indeed.
Are they? Okay. Good. It's mostly guys. Let's face it. It's mostly guys. There are a few people who are very interested. Interesting. I really loved. We did an interview on Triangulation on the making of General Magic. And Megan Smith, who eventually became a Google vice president and the CTO of the United States, was a young engineer who was tasked with building the prototypes for the Magic Leap. Yeah. Not Magic Leap. General Magic device. And Magic Link, they call it. And she's great. She's just her energy and enthusiasm. And she's the kind of woman you see, and any girl watching this will go, yeah, I want to do that. I could do that. So we should get more of those interviews. I'd love to see more of those.
So you were going to surprise us with the thing that...
Yeah, I got four stories you didn't even mention. John Hancock has announced it's going to stop underwriting traditional life insurance and sell only policies that track fitness and health data through wearable devices and smartphones.
Okay, the bigger story there is that they're trying to rename that building in my hometown of Chicago. The Hancock Building is no longer the Hancock Building.
That's the landmark building with the glass floor.
Now it's the Fitbit building.
So bad.
Is it the Fitbit building?
No, I don't know what it is. No.
I hope to God not. It's, you know what? It'll always be the Sears Tower. It'll always be Grant Park.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, by the way, I didn't know you were a Chicagoan.
I am a Chicagoan.
Movie on the airplane. It's called 85, the story of the 1985 Chicago Bears.
Oh,
the Bears. It's the Super Bowl shuffle. Did you know they recorded that after only 12 games?
I would not doubt that. That was a remarkable year.
And it was, they had to go in the day after they lost one game that season, the Miami Dolphins. They had to record it the day after they lost the Miami Dolphins. We're going to the Super Bowl. That's cocky.
It's somewhere on YouTube and it's totally worth watching if you don't know what we're talking about. Yeah.
So bad. But the fridge, William Refrigerator Perry. Of course, amazing running back, Walter Payton, Sweetness. It's a really great movie.
And John, what was his name? It was a little young for the Super Bowl.
The guy with the headbands, Jim McMahon, the quarterback.
Jim McMahon, thank you.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
He's, and by the way, in this movie, woohoo! He's he's a character and a half. It's a great, and of course, Mike Ditka. It's a great
My grandma rode a plane once with Mike Ditka, and she chatted his head off all the way to wherever they were flying.
Oh, I bet. I bet. Anyway, as a Chicagoan, you must see.
I will. I didn't know. I will definitely take one.
85. So that's one. John Hancock. I don't know what they're doing with the building name, but that's, we'd always said that this is the thing that scared people about all this privacy and all, is that at some point insurance companies would start to say, well, did you work out yesterday?
Right.
Now they are. Another one. A coding error sent several hundred Subaru Ascents to the car crusher. Now, we've heard before of coding errors in the firmware of the car, and that you just fix the firmware. This coding error was in the robot arm that did the spot welds.
What's a spot weld?
When they put the thing together, they weld the metal together, right? And the robot arms that are doing they need to hit all the spots. Apparently, the software was buggy and missed some critical spot welds, making it unsafe to drive those cars because they could just fall apart. No physical remedy was available. Therefore, Subaru is destroying the vehicles because of bad code. And finally, we were talking about Salesforce, but I didn't know this. Mark Benioff of Salesforce, he must have a little Jeff Bezos envy because Bezos, of course, personally bought the Washington Post.
That's right.
Benioff is personally buying Time magazine.
He and his wife together have decided to become moguls, and I think that's great, actually.
I think distressed media properties are the new black.
Yeah, well, look. I mean, you said you named the price. This was purchased in 2017 for like 2 point something billion.
Yeah, I remember when Meredith bought a bunch of the flagship, you know, Time Warner stuff, including Time magazine, $2.8 billion. But that was just one of the titles. I think there was other stuff there. There's Sports Illustrated. There's Fortune and Money. Apparently, Meredith says this was a bad investment. Nobody's buying magazines. Duh. Well, Mark Benioff.
Time magazine was the original internet. I mean, the original Time magazine just had like little tiny blurbs of everything that you missed last week.
Well,
years ago.
You're too young to remember this. Maybe Mike does. But when I was a kid, you either got Time or Newsweek.
Mm-hmm.
Newsweek was a little bit more left leaning.
Mm-hmm.
Time had a singularly bad journalistic habit of writing everything as if it was first person happening right now.
Yeah.
Like you were in the room. Yeah. It was fly on the wall journalism. And it was terrible because the impression you got was, oh, they must have been there.
Yeah.
But no, that was just a style.
Yeah.
I used to work for Newsweek.
Newsweek's sad story.
In the no kidding. I was at Newsweek in what I like to call the way before Time.
We were a Newsweek family, you'll be glad to know.
My brain is just totally messed up tonight.
She's high on matzo ball soup.
There. I'm high on Sudafed. I've got my annual cold. At any rate,
who owns Newsweek now? Some terrible Chinese company, right?
IBC. They're not Chinese.
It's a religious. Or something, or, I don't know.
Is it that religious group?
Yeah.
The Washington Post sold it to Sidney Harmon of Harmon Kardon
for $1.
For a buck.
That happened. Right.
And then it merged with the Daily Beast, forming the Newsweek Daily Beast Company, which even a futurist really couldn't predict that would be the
obviously
name of
that
company.
Should have been the Daily News Beast would have been a better name, but
that was Tina Brown.
Tina Brown. That's exactly right.
So it's just spiraled.
It's now owned by IBT Media, which uses it basically as a
it's
its own personal
shell company.
Yeah.
In fact, if you remember when Newsweek relaunched in print, their cover story
remember Satoshi Nakamoto.
Yep. Found him.
And I read that interview, and I'm a fluent Japanese speaker, and like the way that if he was speaking English, no Japanese speaks English in the way that person is quoted.
That's interesting.
The whole thing was
Did they ever say, oh, no, that was wrong? Because they claimed that some poor Japanese guy in L.A.
Names they destroyed this guy's life.
Was the creator of Bitcoin, and it was wrong. I mean, it was wrong. The minute you read the article, you knew, oh, this is completely wrong. Did they ever apologize or retract it or anything?
And what does it matter now if you retract something?
It's already out there.
You know what I mean?
Anyway, I don't know. I honestly don't know if Mark Benioff and his wife will be good stewards of Time magazine. Somehow I doubt it.
Hopefully they invest in it and then leave
it
alone.
Bezos did, which is give them editorial freedom, put money into it, because frankly it looks like these businesses
Time
are
magazine
money
right now is just awful. It's just
is it bad?
It's a terrible publication.
Yeah.
Hopefully they give them runway and they give them engineers.
Yep.
And they don't insist on and the problem with somebody from outside of news, you know, it's a double-edged sword. You kind of need somebody from the outside with a radically different business model to, you know, run the publication. But you also need, you know, because that's the current business models don't work. On the other hand, if you don't grok news, like what it costs to produce news and what the, you know, you wind up with problems.
You also need respect for journalism.
Which is
very old school.
Yeah.
But I think without that, you've got nothing. And it looks like that's you kind of nailed what Bezos did. He gave them the technological wherewithal.
That's right.
But let the editorial continue.
That's right. And the Post is killing it. He hired Marty Baron away. I mean, the Post
Marty Baron, good example.
Yeah, the Post is killing it, but there's a pretty... You know, church and state. There's a big wall.
Who came up though with "Democracy Dies in Darkness"? Because that's the worst slogan.
Yeah,
yeah. That's
is that Marty? I hope it wasn't Marty.
I don't know if it was Marty himself. Like, that was like a yeah.
Finally, we've said over and over that Equifax never paid for the breach, that they got away with murder. Remember, 140 million records, everybody's social, everything leaked to the bad guys, and Equifax executives never suffered for that. There was no fine. There was no punishment. Well, there is now. I'm very happy to say.
Public floggings.
Almost public floggings. A new federal law that was passed on Friday now allows you to freeze and unfreeze your credit in every state of the union for free. The price of this has varied. In some states it was free, but in many states it was as much as $12 per bureau per freeze. Yes.
That's ridiculous.
It was ridiculous.
I didn't know that.
So the federal law now says that you can freeze and unfreeze your credit without being charged. They also increased the length of a fraud alert, which is, so credit freeze is the most draconian thing you can do. You say, you know, don't give anybody any credit information. This is the thing, the credit bureaus, this is why it's a punishment. Hate, because they can't make any money off of you, because they're basically told, no one can ask for my credit report. That's a credit freeze. A fraud alert is a little bit less severe. It tells lenders that your personal data might have been compromised and you should really verify identities before approving credit. Mm-hmm. But those only lasted 3 days. Now they last a year thanks to this new law.
Hmm.
So, this is really good news if you don't like these credit reporting agencies and you want to stick it to them, or if you're concerned, you should investigate both fraud alerts and credit
freezes. Where did this law come from?
That's a really good question.
They deserve a lot of credit, ironically.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is for Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. It's for all three. I have a USA Today article you should probably search for that came out a couple of days ago. Equifax breach, freezing your credit is now free. Search for that because it has the links and the step-by-step on how to do this. You can do this online. And
I'm sure they'll find some other way to screw us.
I think this is the damage. We're making from that, from the three companies we're making per, I wonder if that was a big line item in their budget. Of revenue from the freezing and unfreezing that we would have to pay.
Oh, yeah, I bet they make.
I wonder how much this cuts into their bottom line.
There were some states where the state law said, no, you can't do that's ridiculous. But there were states like California. It was a very expensive process that kept people essentially from doing it, because if you wanted to buy a house or buy a car, you had to unfreeze it. They would charge you to do that and freeze it again. Right. They would charge you to do that. Now it's free. And I don't know who passed that law. I don't even know what the law is.
It's kind of a pain in the neck to freeze your credit, though. I mean, it's...
Well, it's easier than it used to be. It's easier than it used to be. You can actually go to these sites. You do have to type in your name, social, date of birth.
It's kind of interesting that it's not frozen. It should be the other way around. It should be frozen until we need to unfreeze it for something specific.
Well, except for the fact that the only reason that Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion exist is to sell that data. How they make a living.
Yeah.
So, the credit freezes. That's why I call this a punishment.
Yeah.
And it's not just a punishment to Equifax. It's a punishment to all the credit bureaus, because really this is saying, no, you can't.
Something had to be done.
You can't profit off my data.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
you should learn the differences if you're going to take advantage of this, folks, between a freeze and a fraud alert. They may not be appropriate for everybody in every situation. If you're a young person and you're applying for credit cards and buying cars and buying houses, a credit freeze is a bad idea. Somebody like me who no longer does any of that.
We should call for... there to be sort of Facebook to freeze our personal data.
Well,
you know, in a similar
that's
way.
That's what I did.
I like that idea. Yeah.
That's called deactivating your Facebook account.
Deactivating.
And actually what I did is my calendar, I've set it so that, because at Twitter you have to reactivate in a year on my birthday every year, I'm going to react, or no, maybe Christmas. I'll make it Christmas. On Christmas every year, I'm going to reactivate all three accounts for a week, then deactivate them again. And then my account will never go away. My name will be protected.
Yeah.
That's like a credit freeze.
Give yourself a Christmas present.
That's a Facebook freeze.
Yeah.
It's better than freezer head. That, to me, those were the stories that I wanted to say. I am so glad you guys were here, though, to fill me in on what really happened in technology. Amy Webb is a futurist from the Future Today Institute at futuretodayinstitute.com or amywebb.io if you want to go to her personal website. Check out her books. She is always very welcome and always insightful and smart. I'm really glad you were here. And you didn't really have to put your Harvard diploma up on the wall behind you, though. I just want to say.
Oh, this is my
We know you're smart.
My home, it's a hologram. Home office.
We know you're smart.
It's a hologram, yeah. I'm a hologram.
I'm just jealous because I got nothing like that to put on my... I got my high school diploma. Can I put that up? Santa Cruz High. Man, there's an institution.
You got a Santa Cruz High.
I did. Wow. I even graduated from Santa Cruz High, so somewhere I got one of them.
Heard of people being high in Santa Cruz, but not
yeah,
Santa Cruz
no,
High.
We were. Just like Joe Rogan and Elon Musk. Mike Elgin, he is a gastronomad, and go to elgin.com to subscribe to his newsletter.
Please do.
Mike's
Thank
list
you.
Is great. A weekly read that is must. Just that's the best way to keep up on all the cool stuff that happened. And don't forget those gastronomad trips.
Gastronomad.net. If you like food and
they sound
wine
amazing.
And travel.
Don't they sound great?
You
yeah,
should
they
join
sound really
you should
great.
Join us, Amy. You and your yeah. husband. He's in the eyeball business, you know. He's got
We'll do it virtually.
Tons of money.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. It's just a matter of time. Now, see, that's faux intimacy right there. I think I'm in Prosecco, but really I'm
And the Prosecco doesn't quite taste the
same. I'm literally in the Prosecco.
Yes, right. Swimming.
With digital fish and little robots.
Somebody said, Santa Cruz High, is that where Jeff Spicoli went? Yeah, Fast Times at Santa Cruz High. You saw the movie. That was me. Hey, it's been great to come back and see you all. I promise not to leave for so long ever again. That was really too long.
Was it?
Yeah,
not really.
No, it was you know, 3 weeks. That was the longest
that's a long time
I've ever taken off. It was almost a month.
It's a long time to be gone from your fans who missed you.
It's not so much that. Anyway, no, I do. I missed you all. Thank you for being here. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon. And thanks also to Ian Thompson and Becky Worley, who filled in for me. Who else am I missing? Jason?
Jason Snell.
Jason Howell. Snell. That's right. Mark Snell. He did the first one. Thanks to them for filling in for me. I really appreciate that. I should also thank the guy who did the radio show.
Rich.
What's his name? He's on TV in Los Angeles.
Rich DeMuro.
I don't know why I blank his name out. Probably because I'm worried. He's young. He's good looking. He's smarter than I am.
It's like De Niro with an M. It's
yeah, Rich M. De Niro. That's his name. That's it.
De Niro.
I'm a little punchy. Because, you know, it's like 4 a.m. in Barcelona.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific. If you want to be in our studio audience, we had a great studio audience today. Thank you all for coming. Just email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a chair out for you, and I'll add you to my postcard list. you can get some postcards in. Tickets at twit.tv. We also stream it live at twit.tv/live, so you can watch there, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. That's 2200 UTC. If you can't watch live, you can't be here live. Well, I guess you could always watch or listen to our podcast, the on-demand version, available at your convenience. Just go to twit.tv, our website, for any of our shows, or subscribe in your favorite podcast program because we're there. And that way you'll get it each week as soon as we're done. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another Twit.
This is in the can. Amazing.
Doing the Twit.